Hey, kids.
You're listening to the internet's wettest podcast about video games, consoles,
and pancakes.
The SML Podcast.
What's up, everybody? This is the SML Podcast. I am your host, Joe. We are back after a week-long break because my fucking video card died. But it is a party cast, and we've got a whole crew of people here. Chris is here. Brooke is here. Purnell's here. Tim's here. Big Adam is here. And Aki is here. How is everybody doing?
Pretty good.
Really good.
Adequate.
Well, one of the dogs I'm dog sitting just shit all over my floor.
You're doing great.
Better go play.
Yeah, I am doing better than that.
The worst part was I brought them fucking outside and I stood out there until they decided they wanted to go in. And the moment we got in, they copped a squat and crapped on my floor.
That's good
luck.
That's
just sending a message.
Yeah, that dog fucking hates me.
That's like they know what they know what they did there.
Was the dog staring at you as it did?
It was exactly what it did. It's an asshole. And it wonders why I put it in timeout in its kennel so often, because it craps on my floor on purpose.
Yeah, since you put it in the kennel so much, that's why it crapped on your floor.
Yeah.
Very.
It's a vicious cycle.
Yeah,
perpetual motion machine.
Perpetual motion. I could just imagine the dog coming in and just staring at Aki and like, you know what? This is happening.
It's done that before. It's done that before.
If I don't. That's right. That's right. I'm here. Hey.
Nice. Also a little loud.
Yeah, it was. That's pretty loud, though. But...
At the same time, they are on our end, yeah.
I laughed, so fuck them crickets.
That's all that matters.
That's right.
Adam, how are you doing?
You know, can't complain. I had pizza. That's always a win.
Yeah, that's good. Cool.
What kind of pizza are we talking?
Oh, just pepperoni. I'm a basic kind of guy.
That's classic. That's the first pizza you got to get from a new place. Test them out, too.
Yeah. You gotta know. A lot of pizza places in this area.
Yeah, Pennsylvania small town areas are like big on pizza.
Yeah, they certainly are. It's basically one of the only things available around here. I really wish there was an Indian spot close by, and there's not. It's a real bummer.
That is a bummer.
I feel like it's weird. I feel like even though pizza for the layman is probably a pain in the ass to bake from scratch, like as to get the dough at all just right and all, I feel like in the restaurant industry, it must be one of the easiest things to make.
Yeah.
It's not that hard to make, even at home. It's really not.
You just got to get your oven super, super, super hot. That's all.
It's like you've made the dough from scratch before, like kneaded it, like, you know, basically mixed it, kneaded it, prepped it.
I've done that.
Damn, cool.
And you're being serious. You're not wanting some DiGiorno shit, right? Like, I made it myself.
No, I've made it from scratch. Yeah,
I do. Yeah. I usually
prefer just to buy store bought stuff just because it's faster. But when I want something personally made, usually I don't make my dough if I don't have to. I usually just buy already made dough and then just spread it out to the size I want and make the rest of the pizza. Because you can just buy already ready pizza dough. You don't have to make it from scratch anymore. And it's not quite as good, but it's fine. It's serviceable.
You know, if pizza you're buying already made pizza dough, you can get already made pizza, too.
This is right.
I know, but that I get. I'm saying
is like non-existent.
Yeah, so I'm thinking about that stuff for us.
But I guess restaurants. No, I think about. I guess maybe restaurants do the thing where they buy like the dough balls and they just flatten it out. Like they don't have to actually make the dough from scratch. They just buy the pre-made dough balls.
Somebody got to make that dough.
Christ, there it is. Yes.
Love it.
Dough money.
A week off, and the bad puns are still there.
I'll never go away.
What I love about pizza is that the more homemade it is, the worse it is.
I don't know about that, unlike
a lot of foods. Well, it's just like unless you have a whole ass pizza oven and like, you know, the equipment and
you know.
You can make.
I mean, it doesn't come out wood oven. It wouldn't come out wood oven toasted. But I make some hot. Yeah. I'll make some pretty hot pieces. Like when I do make it here, just like I said, I'm buying pre-made crust and slapping my own sauce and toppings and cheese combination on there. But my pieces are shit.
Or you can make all that stuff yourself as an extra step, and then it tastes even worse. That's all my point is.
It tastes worse when you home make it completely. It's probably because you fucked up making the dough.
No, I don't think
so. These more preservatives.
I truly think that they got it right in the pizza restaurants.
Yeah, they know what they're doing. 16-year-old
in the back,
lots of
putting that stuff around.
Oh yes,
the giant oven helps.
They What's smack it up, favorite? Flip it, then they rub it down a bit. It's a good pizza.
What's everybody's fave pizza topping?
Pepperoni. I'm classic.
Grab a second fave. You had to pick one other.
Beef and extra sausage.
My typical combo is broccoli and black olive.
Broccoli on a pizza. That is legit.
It's really good.
You know what? I hate broccoli. Sausage on a pizza, I've discovered.
Really?
Whoa, get that shit off of there. Right. Like,
what about, I guess like is, I feel like I've chorizo, which is a very rare thing to get access to on a pizza, but chorizo sausage on a pizza is freaking boppers.
Fancy boy over here.
Right. Chorizo is good on pizza. Everything.
Big
Unlike most other foods, actually, what I really love on a pizza is onions.
Yeah, I like onions on a pizza.
Fair enough, onions. Yeah.
I hate onions on everything.
Same.
Right. Mushrooms. I normally get raw onions. I normally get no onions it's not raw onion on a pizza. And you bake it on.
I'm just saying.
They don't throw it on after the pizza's done.
Right, yeah.
They better not.
Don't fuck this up.
I mean, I guess if you're doing it at home, you have that option.
Watching.
Again.
Who wants to lose customers? Who wants to lose some customers? Onion that shit up. But,
I think my favorite topping on a pizza is hamburgers.
Like full hamburgers with the bun?
Yes.
I've had that before.
That is, there are pizza places that have that. I've never been there, but I know that's my favorite topping.
Wait, what? As ground hamburger makes sense. You're telling me some crazy place is just slapping patties on a pizza?
No, not patties. Patties,
bun, the whole
vegetables, sauce, like with an actual bun. Whole Big Mac on top of a pizza. Yeah, that's the thing.
That's so fucking ridiculous.
They even have fries and shit on there, too. It's crazy, and I'm like, I want to try that.
There
it's
is like a...
That are like, you know, that's like people that are like, you know, you can have a pizza sub by taking a pizza and wrapping it around a sub. Like, you know what else you can fucking do? Just put the goddamn pizza toppings in the sub. Why you gotta get ridiculous with it? Just put the shit in it.
Yeah, there's a pizza place that's very near my house. Is actually where I usually go now. They're pretty demented. They make some whack ass pizzas. They have chicken and waffle
whack ass.
Okay, so hang on,
chicken and waffle up right now.
They have chicken and waffle pizza. I'm just saying, like, you know, who would do
the waffle situation on the pizza?
Genius is wood. Genius is wood. Because pizzas.
Where's their Instagram?
We should have shifted to the Ninja Turtle pizza shop joint decades ago. And the fact that we have it, and you got random pop ups like the one you're describing, is a travesty. There should be more of them. We used to have a place near me that had hoisin sauce on the pieces. They put carrots, peanuts, hoisin pork, and a number of spices and such. And that was just one piece. They had a bunch of them. And of course they wanted to business.
How about some boneless wing crust pizza?
I'm all for that.
I'd eat it.
Yeah. I'm not saying these are bad. I'm just saying they're
wack
out of their mind. Yeah.
There's
wake and bake pizza, which is mozzarella, pepperoni, jalapenos, tater tots, and waffle fries.
That would probably be delicious.
Yeah, again.
I'm there without the jalapenos. I'm not a jalapeno guy.
But if they cut it really thin and sprinkle it on instead of having just big old slices on it, I think it'd still be fine.
Yeah,
we have a pizza place by us. They tout their pierogi pizza, which is literally just bread, mashed potatoes, cheese, and butter.
Right. Crab Rangoon pizza.
Okay,
and then you get a side of gravy and dip it. Mm-hmm.
What's on the Crab Rangoon pizza? That sounds good.
Well, featuring egg rolls, Asiago mozzarella, sweet orange chili sauce, sweet garlic teriyaki drizzle, and there's like little Crab Rangoons on there.
That should be the most popular pizza joint in your area. What the fuck?
Yeah.
That sounds like a dining adventure to me.
It is.
Cats are just buying meat lovers.
Yeah, they do a lot of. I mean, they, yeah, but it just they do some stuff.
Tim, don't get
they
mad.
They do some magic stuff.
What's up? I live in Buffalo.
Buffalo doesn't Buffalo have like a weird chicken tender sub with like mozzarella on it? I feel like I'm
no.
I'm thinking of something else. All right.
No, our signature chicken finger involved sub is the stinger, which is chicken fingers and it's like if you made a steak hoagie and a chicken finger sub the same thing.
I just want you all to steak understand. And chicken. I hate you all right now. I want pizza so bad now.
I want pizza too. I'm totally hungry.
Well, I want pizza, but since I can't have what that place is serving, I don't even care.
I respect that.
We're at a party cast and nobody brought any pizza.
Oh my god. How could we have been so foolish?
Talk for yourself. I have pizza right now.
Oh my god.
I had chili crisp broccoli. That's close enough for me for now.
Speaking of Adam, I got to give Adam a big shout out for helping get the show back on track. Last week, when we were about to go live with our Tuesday show, my video card decided it didn't want to work anymore with OBS. And my computer would just completely seize up anytime I tried to open OBS or do anything related to the show, which is always good when you're trying to produce a weekly show. So, Adam, you were awesome enough to suggest a couple video cards for my computer, and we got it in, and it's working as good as I could do on my own. So
nice, which means it's totally working because it either works or it doesn't. Yeah. So,
thank goodness.
I get some weird flickers on my one monitor every now and then, but I don't know.
That might be a cable issue.
It might be. I don't know. But yeah, big shout out to you, Adam, for helping out. So.
Oh yeah, no problem.
Thank you, Adam.
Thanks for getting the show back on track.
Oh yeah.
Speaking of getting back on track, we have 2 weeks of reviews we got to catch up on. Is everybody ready to talk Vidgy games?
Ready.
Instead of weird pizza.
I'm down to keep talking either.
Yeah, both is good. Either or.
All right, well, first pizza to talk about tonight. DiGiorno stuffed pizza. Did you guys hear DiGiorno? They don't just have a stuffed crust. They have a stuffed pizza now.
I did not know about this, and I'm a big fan of the DiGiorno.
Like a double-decker pizza.
It's just, instead of stuffed crust, it's a whole layer of cheese in the crust through the entire pizza.
I'm going to pull this up.
It is very excessive.
I got to try it.
But yeah, it's just like a double-decker pizza. That's a thing.
Yeah. It's good, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If McDonald's can get me to try the Air, Land, and Sea, which was not that great, by the way, can I just say that on the DL? DiGiorno can get me to try their stuff.
You know what? Just put more cheese on top of the pizza. I don't know.
There you go.
They really are kind of stingy on that top of the pizza cheese, aren't they?
What is the Air, Land, and Sea, though? What's that?
It's a McDonald's sandwich that came out, what was it, last year? The air part is a chicken patty. The sea part is a fish patty. And the lamb part is a burger patty. And it's all in one sandwich.
Interesting.
I like how you didn't classify it as beef. You're like, it's from their burgers. Source animal unknown.
It's one of the only fast food restaurants I haven't worked at, so I can't make that claim, but other ones that will remain nameless, I may not be willing to call that beef either.
Name names.
Talk about.
All right, yeah, let's get to reviews. We have a lot of games to talk about. Tim, you ready? You're leading things off.
I guess. Yeah.
All right.
It's weird.
Why? Getting back to
it? It's weird because I was like ready to go last week and then we stopped. We had to stop. And then I spent most of the weekend not playing Jedi Survivor and playing something different.
Word.
But we're going to do
this. Something with a link in it.
Yeah.
All right. Well, first game to talk about tonight is Star Wars Jedi Survivor, developed by Respawn, published by Electronic Arts, released April 28th on Xbox Series X and S, PS5, and PC for $69.99. The story of Cal continues in Star Wars Jedi Survivor, a galaxy-spanning third-person action-adventure game. One of the last surviving Jedi Knights, Cal is driven to make a stand during the galaxy's darkest times. But how far is he willing to go to protect himself, his crew, and the legacy of the Jedi Order? Tim, tell us about Star Wars Jedi Survivor.
I'm so jealous.
Yeah, you should be. It's really good. So, yeah, Jedi Survivor. Let me take you back once a minute here to Fallen Order, the first game of this series, which came out like almost 4 years ago at this point. It was pre-COVID, so, you know, calculate that into your mind for how long ago it was. And
17
that it was,
years.
Yeah, exactly. It was a long time between installments in this series. Yeah, Fallen Order was pretty good. I enjoyed it. It was kind of an interesting panache of different like video game genres mashed into now Star Wars. In particular, I think a lot of people were not, and myself included, were not expecting it to lean so much into like Dark Souls as it did. With having instead of bonfires, there's meditation points, and when you stop to rest, it respawns all the enemies, and when you get killed, it kind of drops your stuff slash attaches it to that enemy, and you have to go get it back. Though it wasn't that much stuff, and it's not in this one. It's just the experience that you've earned since the last level. And a bit, I don't know, I thought the first one was kind of tough. Heavy emphasis on pairing mechanics in the combat. I like the first one pretty decent. I had some issues with it that I felt kind of got in the way of me having as good an experience as I possibly could. Part of that just being kind of the level design. I had like a tough time navigating a lot of the levels. I found it cumbersome, just trying to get from point A to point B sometimes, even with the map, and just kind of not understanding where shortcuts weren't always placed in the best way, and then getting tripped up on enemies a lot. But this, you know, Jedi Survivor feels like they looked at Fallen Order and saw all the stuff that maybe wasn't as great or wasn't as fun as it could be, and they're like, well, we're going to make that all way better. Or, you know, they kind of turned down the Dark Souls, turned that down, and turn up like the more adventure-y Tomb Raider style action of the game. So I'm just, in generally speaking, feeling less bogged down with combat. Even though those mechanics are still there, I feel like the parry timing, it works for me a lot better in this game than it did in the first one. I just feel like there's, you know, the levels are more open. When you're opening shortcuts, they just make sense. Like the levels just flow a lot better. And when they double back on themselves, it's like, okay, I can see where this shortcut takes me. This makes sense. I know I'm going to get back here. It is not a long and winding road. It all checks out. I mean, it does, in the sense of the construction of, I guess, a level that exists in a realistic fictional world, it's like, man, why are there just like wires and zip lines shooting off all over the place? And just, who cares? It's a video game. You need them there to have fun.
Looking for logic.
So that's better. And just a lot more good, like platforming, climbing, wall running, exploring, adventure-y stuff that feels good. And I always, you know, I love that particular genre of, you know, your Tomb Raiders, your Prince of Persia's, like those games always feel really good and fun to me, and there's a lot of that in a good way in this one. So anyways, you start off Cal Kestis, that's your Jedi boy. All your crew and friends from the previous game, they've kind of disbanded and gone their own separate ways, and Cal has like a new crew of friends that he is using to try to disrupt the Empire's plans. You catch up with him in the middle of a mission on Coruscant, the big city covered planet in the center of the Star Wars galaxy, where you're trying to hold up a senator for a bunch of information. And this just kind of serves to reintroduce you to all of Cal's powers and the mechanics of the game. One of the super cool things about this game is, rather than come up with some contrived way to, like, I don't know, cut off Cal Kestis's connection with the Force or some bullshit like that, so that you have to like get all of your abilities back, they're just like, nah, here's all your abilities. Here you go. You can just start with all of them. Yeah, have fun. Nice. You pull with the force. You push with the force. You can throw your lightsaber. Your lightsaber can split into two lightsabers. And you have the dual bladed lightsaber. You have different lightsaber stances. You can wall run. You can double jump, or force flip or Jedi flip. That's what they call it. You have your Jedi mind trick, mind control. They give you a grappling hook, like right off the bat.
What do they do in terms of like level progression and new abilities?
Well, in terms of progression, so one, just to say, yeah, they start you off with a whole kit of stuff, and that feels great, and that's really good. So you don't feel limited in any way off the beginning of the game. So what there is, one new force ability, it's not really something you use in combat, but they involve Cal like being able to communicate with like different alien animals a lot for being able to traverse levels and get from point A to point B, and that's a new thing and kind of fun. But you have a substantial amount of skill trees going on in this game. There's seven or eight of them. They're not all like huge, but so there's like one for like your survivability, like, ooh, more health, whatever. There's three broken up for your different like force powers that just, you know, so making you, giving you different options for pushing and pulling enemies around or doing the mind control stuff or just, you know, increasing your force recovery or whatever. And then there's five of them that are dedicated to the five different lightsaber stances that are available in this game, which they dole out to you relatively quickly. They're all in like the first half of the game. I have all five of them. So one of them is just like your standard two hands on a lightsaber, all very familiar. One is the dual bladed, like Darth Maul style lightsaber. One is, you know, lightsabers akimbo. And then they give you one where, one hand you have a lightsaber, the other hand you have a blaster. So you're like a gunslinger fencer sort of style. I like that one. I've been using that one a lot. And then the last one is the crossguard style lightsaber, which is like your Kylo Ren style, looks like a claymore. And that one is more of a slow, powerful, more defensive style that I don't use because it's not fast enough. And I just want faster combat going on. But yeah, each one of those.
Time for that. It's clobbering time.
I ain't got time for that. I mean, just in my, and I like that style of combat generally in Souls type games. Or when it's available, yeah, sure, give me the big great sword that, you know, I don't need to hit him a lot. I just need to hit him once real hard. But in this, I'm preferring the faster attacks. So each one of those has its own little tree that, you know, you can get more moves and abilities and upgrade that. So there's plenty to spend your points on as you accrue them. And beyond, okay, so yeah, you do that, you get off Coruscant, you get to the first big planet, which ends up Kobo, that's what it's called. It's been a week, played a lot of Zelda. You land on this planet called Hyrule, right, okay. Yeah, Kobo, and that, and
use the master sword, the double
that master is going sword. To the master saber. Yeah, Kobo, it ends up being kind of the central main hub of the game. It is a pretty, is a vast, large, pretty open planet, with just tons of side stuff and important story stuff to do there. You'll kind of go in there, you'll finish like the first mission, which is going to check out this forest array. You meet a guy there who prompted my wife to say, "Who is this Sephiroth looking motherfucker?" And me to say, "Oh, I'm sure he's probably going to be the main antagonist if we just give him a little bit of time." And apparently a little bit of time was about 4 minutes. just like, oh no, why is he turning his kyber crystal red?
We ain't got time.
We ain't got time for it. Let's get this plot a rolling. And yeah, so there's lots of places to explore there initially. And this is a don't hang around the hinterland situation from like Dragon Quest Inquisition, Age Inquisition. Don't hang around Kobo too much. Do the story stuff. Start unlocking some other planets, some other abilities. You'll be back to Kobo plenty. You don't need to do everything in your first run. So you're going to go off to some other planets. You're going to, you know, meet up with some familiar faces. The plot kind of revolves around this planet, a planet that is hidden in the Kobo Abyss, which is, you know, some space bullshit that hangs out near Kobo. And you're trying to figure out a way to navigate through there to find this planet that would be a good place to hide away safe from the Empire. And who knows what other Jedi secrets might await you there. You're trying to get there. The bad guy's trying to get there. And you're trying to unravel, like, what all happened with it. Some place way in the past in, like, the High Republic era, which is, you know, thousands of years ago. So, yeah. You, the game opens up. You get a couple different planets to go to as you're trying to collect information. These planets are big. Not quite as open as Kobo is, but still just like a lot of, you know, I shouldn't say that because Jedha gets really open at a certain point. When you're riding around a desert on like this giant, like super tall giraffe thing. and yeah, there's just like lots of side stuff to explore, like little collectibles to find. And then a lot of it ties back into back on Kobo in the cantina there. This is like a huge red flag for me in my time is when the game was like, oh yeah, you can find people throughout the galaxy to send back here to start building up the town. I'm like, oh man, I love me a good town building, like side quest mini game thing. And sure enough, you find people to send back to Kobo and they'll unlock more side quests and more stuff to do. Some act as like vendors when you find certain collectibles that you can trade for. Oh man, there's, you know, cosmetic stuff for like Cal's appearance. There are perks that you can equip on your character. There's like blaster parts. Some are cosmetic, some give you different damage options. There is mini games. There is a fish tank that you need to clean up with a, oh, what is the guy's name? It's Scuba Steve. Is the guy's name who runs the fish tank. there is, yeah, there's, no, I'm thinking of a different game. There's just like a lot to do to keep you checked. There's gardening to do when you get back there. Just like lots of stuff to keep you busy. And it all seems pretty interesting and engaging to do when you just need a break from everything else. And, you know, you get more abilities that will unlock more areas that will get you into more side questy stuff. There's just like lots of stuff to get and it always feels pretty rewarding. You know, just different, even if it's just like just different options for customizing your lightsaber. All the side stuff.
I love when games like this have these kind of side quests and side activities you could do. Like, I got to save the galaxy, but first my tulips need watering.
Yeah. I mean, the galaxy doesn't seem imminently threatened any more than it does at any other point in this period of the Star Wars history. You know, you got to take your time. You got to take some time out for you too. You know, you can't be saving the galaxy if you're all stressed out. So yeah, there's lots to do. It feels really good. You can ride little like Star Wars space chocobos around, on Kobo. That's great. In terms of the kind of the big fuss about this game since it came out, if somehow you didn't hear about it, is that particularly on PC, it's a fucking mess. And that seems to be mainly a PC issue. From what I've gathered talking with my friend who's playing on PC, there's like there's a problem sometimes when there's a disparity between like the power of your processor and the power of the graphics card. And it's not like utilizing cores properly and just like making the game crash and the frame rate tank and like some shit go wrong, but they've been like patching it pretty regularly. I will say at least, I've been playing our review codes on the PS5. So I'm playing on the PS5. It's been fine. I have had no crashes or weird bugs or anything. It doesn't run at like a full 60 frames, even in performance mode, but it doesn't run at like a terrible frame rate either. A lot of places still, look quite pretty, I would say. It's still a pretty good looking game. Even though graphics snobs will get up in arms about how these consoles and games can't do 4K and 60 frames per second. That's
why
fine.
Can't my $500 console perform like an $1,800 graphics card?
I mean, yeah. I mean, yeah. It's okay to expect, you know, better performance out of these consoles that you spent a good amount of money on. But at the same time, not every game has to meet those benchmarks to be fun to play.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, and Jedi Survivor is fun to play. It is improved upon the original in pretty much every way that I can think of. It just feels great going out there in the world, like you know, deflecting blaster bolts and chopping dudes in half, doing all that great Star Wars stuff. It will never get old using force push to fling a stormtrooper off a cliff. It will never, ever, ever get old. It is always awesome.
That's the Skyrim business right there.
Yeah. Also, pulling them directly into a lightsaber thrust also feels very good. It's really good. It is of a robust length. What's up?
I know you can customize your lightsabers and stuff.
Yeah.
Is there a nice purple lightsaber by any chance?
Yes.
Is there a really cool black Sith-like outfit you can wear for Cal?
Probably.
And have you finished the game yet?
I have not finished it, no.
I heard there's, after you beat it, there's New Game Plus, and apparently they added stuff to it, and I want to know what that is.
Okay, yeah, I do not, it's, well, you know, I would have finished it, maybe, except, one Zelda came out.
Oh.
But, I mean, I played like a good 15 hours of this, don't get me wrong. But you know, I'm doing a lot of side stuff. I was not gonna rush through it.
Yeah, you're enjoying
by any
your
means,
time.
But yeah, absolutely. But
enjoying your time with Zelda.
Oh, one more question. Are there any new cute crew members? Because Marin from the first one was yes. Any
I wish
ones?
She is in this one, I'll tell you that.
Ooh.
You do get to hang around with her quite a bit on Jedha. You don't
do
know
enough. See faces yet?
you kind of cuddle at one point. There's a little bit of cuddling when you're journeying with her. I mean,
I'm already happier.
Yeah. No, well, there's
this is on Aki's wish list. Should it be on everyone else's wish list?
Yes, it should. It's Star
Wars. Yeah. Absolutely. Like it's better than the first one. I don't know. I guess your mileage may vary if you are anti-Star Wars, but if you are pro-Star Wars...
I guess the big question is, will Trekkies love this one?
Who fucking cares?
Yeah, yes, they will, because...
They should. Everybody should enjoy it, because it's a good game. It's got a lot of good stuff going on. Even if you're not into everything else, there's a little recap of the story at the beginning. You know, it's great.
$70, an official verdict on it?
Hey, I mean, it was on sale for 60 like 3 days after it came out. I've seen deals, I think maybe as low as like 52. But yeah, it's worth the money for sure. It is a definitive buy it. Like, this is what you want out of a, you know, that games are just $70 now. AAA games are $70, but this is what you want out of your $70. It is good length. It is a good looking game. It is a lot of fun. There's a lot of different stuff to do. It's great. It's awesome. Cool. Yeah, I've played a lot of Zelda, but I also didn't like have access to the PlayStation over the weekend because my wife was playing the Diablo 4 server slam. Come on and jam. Come on down and slam.
The fact that they used that song for the advertising was incredible.
Yeah.
Gotta hand it to him.
Hell yeah. I don't think it's out of the question that like I break from Zelda to play more Jedi Survivor. Like it's that good.
Nice.
But boy, did I do a really fucking awesome sequence in Zelda tonight. Like, holy shit, it was awesome.
Next game to talk about Zelda, Tears of the Kingdom.
Yeah, I wish.
I'm really holding back. It is really cute how I will like one thing I love. I mean, this show's gonna go long. Get used to it. Is like, you know, I'll turn on my Switch at night and there's actually like a bunch of people all online playing Zelda, like the same game, which takes me back to like the 360 days on Xbox Live in like 2009 when I had like a ton of friends. We'd all be playing like the same new release game like every night. There'd just be people online playing games like every night, and it felt cool.
Brought that me was back the to best that. Era.
Yeah, it was great. It felt so good, and it just takes me back a little bit. Just like see all those people online, and everyone's playing Zelda, and like Brooke is being a little sneak in there, and she's actually playing Breath of the Wild and not Tears of the Kingdom. She's the combo breaker, or she's playing some Otome game for review. I'm guessing, but yeah.
Or Chris playing Final Fantasy.
It's true.
Word. I was convinced on Twitter to finish Breath of the Wild before I jump into Tears of the Kingdom.
You didn't finish it. You have like 400 hours into it, Brooke. What are you
doing? Okay. I've also discussed on Twitter that I have hundreds of hours in games that made me zone out and think about all my personal failures of my entire life. So a lot of game time isn't real. But yeah, I think I'm like three quarters of the way through. I have one of the bosses left, and I assume there's a lot of stuff after that. And my friend Forrest was like, "Yo, dude, you need to fucking finish this before you get back in."
Close it out.
So I get in there and I'm like, okay, I'm gonna do this. I'm gonna beat this game. Like, I don't fucking remember how to fight or move. I don't know how to open my inventory. So that's where I'm at, dude. I'm kind of torn.
How do my abilities work? What's going on?
I was like, oh shit, there's Magnesis or whatever. Anyway, so we'll see how far I get into that, or if I break and get to the next game by when I see y'all next week. Very torn this weekend. My friend told me he was like, it's like an incredibly fun part of the game towards the end, and I was like, all right, man.
Yeah, I did the opposite there. I just like, you know, the Breath of the Wild, I feel like I missed my boat. I missed my chance there. But like, if I enter this game already coming in knowing, in my mind anyway, this is not Zelda, this is Tears of the Kingdom, flat out, will I approach this differently? Especially since I heard people claim that the map shares a lot of commonalities with the original, with Breath of the Wild, but they changed some things. So it was like, okay, well, I'll just experience the whole thing fresh. And so far, I've been appreciating it. Like,
cool.
It's like, you might, I mean, if you find yourself being like, screw it, I'm moving forward, you'll still enjoy it, I think, because I'm coming at it completely Breath of the Wild-less. So.
Breathless.
I feel that. And I've, like, Tim's one of the only people who has seen... Tim's one of the only people who's seen all my game hours in games that I should be done playing by now. Like, let's not talk about how many game hours are in Elden Ring, because like, I can't just walk away from that guy. Like, when I have a big open world game that I'm really loving, I really drag it out because I'm like dreading it being over. So there's like, part of me is like, oh, I should finish Breath of the Wild. But there's another like psychological part of me in the back that's like, oh, if I make myself finish Breath of the Wild, maybe I'm adding 100 more hours onto an experience. You know what I mean? So there's a lot going on here.
We don't got to linger on this any longer. We should probably just move on.
Adam's like, sitting here like, you can brought we it up. My game already.
Hey, it's wait, 2 weeks happened? Of content in one show.
It's true. Yeah. But don't talk to me about my game hours. No, I'll talk about it anytime. Just don't get me started.
The 2-for-1 pizza cast.
Keep my game hours out your fucking mouth. Oh man. All right. Next game to talk about is TT Isle of Man Right on the Edge 3, developed by Raceward Studio, published by Nacon, released May 11th on Xbox One, Series X and S, Switch, PS4, PS5, and Steam for $49.99. Iconic course for motorbike fans, 200 kilometers of open roads to practice on, challenging physics, and a simulation for the best riders. Adam, are you the best riders?
Good Christ, no. all right. So let's start with the good. Let's start with the good, the positive, and then we'll move into the negative.
Okay.
For those that don't know, the Isle of Man TT is a race that's been going on for over 100 years. It started in 1907. So this is a very prestigious event, and it's got worldwide acclaim. It is a massive yearly time trial around the entirety of the Isle of Man, which lies in the UK. The game definitely speaks to the prestigiousness. The game's very pretty. It's got a huge open map that you can ride around and explore. Just basically what the advertisement said. You can do unofficial, like, time trial races. You can do official races. You can do online time trials. It's a pretty complete motorcycle racing experience. The audio, the bikes, they all sound absolutely real, which is something that I find a lot of racing games have problems with these days, is realistic audio. We were at it for a couple years, and we've slowly moved away from it, which is weird to me, but here we are. The UI is incredibly friendly. It's very easy to navigate between all the different kind of race types you want to do and the different kind of bikes and the different riders you would like to participate as and the different classes and what have you. And for the downside of the game is it's entirely unplayable.
Oh no.
Yeah. It's the physics are so slow and molassesy. And I did about an hour of research and an hour of in-game tinkering with other people that have apparently also experienced this with this game. And for some reason, two things. One, there isn't a setting that makes the game feel playable, which is wild to me. Feel playable. The main problem with the game is you can get the responsiveness of the act of going into a turn and turning the bike. You can make that as quick as you want. But the return to center is so unfathomably slow that you unintentionally crash all the time. And you basically have to force yourself into learning to turn 2 to 3 seconds before any turn even appears on screen. And it's just, I put 2 hours of gameplay into this, and I couldn't even do a 2.5 minute time trial without crashing twice. Like, the best I could manage was crashing only twice in a 2.5 minute time trial.
Wow. And Pernell, you covered one of these in the past, didn't you? Was it a Ride on the Edge, or was it a different motorbike game that you played? I know you and I have both put some time into these kind of games, and we've struggled. And Adam, you are good at racing games, and the fact that you're struggling is worrisome.
I'm not sure if it's the same series or not, but is it a bike racing game where when you go onto the turn, they bring up the colorful line to indicate this is what will happen if you turn sharp or if you turn light, and you got to, like you just said, kind of come into the turn, ready to turn before the turn actually arrives, and even still, you're just like, whoop, wobble, there I go on the ground again. Like,
Sort of. So the thing that you're referring to is pretty standard in a lot of racing games. It's not specific to bike games by any stretch. That's called the preferred racing line. And basically green means go faster or go as fast as you can. Yellow means you're going to have to let up off the throttle. And red means you're going to have to slow down before you take this or the vehicle that you're using can't handle. This game does have that, and while it is helpful for the speed management, again, it's the return from I've just turned the bike hard right. The return to I'm now going straight is unadjustable, and it's molasses.
Yeah, that sounds like a pain in the ass.
So you end up finding yourself like overcorrecting a lot.
You're overcorrecting to the point where you can't get yourself in a straight line, which means you're sacrificing most of your speed. And then you come up to another S-turn or another chicane as you're just getting corrected into center and you don't have enough time to react into the turn and you blow off the side of the road and you've fallen off the bike. It was tough. It was tough, and I had super high hopes for that game because it's so pretty. And again, the race is so prestigious, and I love motorcycles. It was just
to confirm something, like, you're not like Joe and I, and it's just that like we might come out to something like this and say, well, if this is more of an arcade racer, it would be doable. Like you play sim racers as well, and this is still your return response to it, right?
I have had my motorcycle license for 10 years. I know how motorcycles work because I ride them.
there it is.
No motorcycle on planet Earth takes as long to recover into a straight vertical position that it does in this game. Under any settings that I was able to uncover, it was like, it was super disappointing. Gotta give this one a hard thumbs down, unfortunately. Very, very pretty, but the play is just all wrong.
Damn, that's a bummer. I was hoping with someone who knew what they were doing, they'd be able to figure out the Isle of Man games, because as much as I want to get into them, I can't control them. Can't do it.
Yep. This makes me feel a little bit better about my performance in these games, because I'm always like, maybe it was me. No, maybe it's the goddamn game.
Maybe. And there are, you know, Superbike Simulator games that work just fine. Like, I've played a game called Track Day R. I played it for its motocross side, because motocross is my forte. But I have played dozens of hours on the Superbike side just to mess around with some street racing, and I can control that game just fine, and that is a simulator. That is a real racing physics simulator. I've played the Ride series, and the Ride series, while it is tough to control at first, it's only tough to control at first because you're trying to make the equivalence of real life experience into a thumb analog stick. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But getting around that learning curve only takes an amount of time. This game, I just felt that the actual physics and mechanics of the game itself and the inability to adjust the back to center really, really, really hinders this game from a playability standpoint almost entirely.
Damn. Well, if we get any word of updates or patches, maybe we could get you to take another look at it. And if there's any significant changes, we could update people. But it seems like you're pretty set on giving this one a deny it.
Unfortunately, I do have to deny it. But worry not, friendos. Your friendly racing correspondent has been given a new task. And the new task is absolutely awesome. And I've been enjoying the crap out of it so far.
Nice.
So prepare for positivity from Big Adam the next go round.
Nice.
I mean, yes.
Well, that is it for you tonight. Did you want to stick around or were you going to head out?
I'm probably actually going to go head out because, coincidentally enough, I got the offer to go do some sim driving with some actual sim racing folks. So I'm going to go do that for a little while.
Hell yeah.
Well, Adam, thank you so much for joining us and hanging out with us. Do you have any final words before we let you go?
Yeah. American Aftermarket with gear and peripherals. Just stop all the things that you're doing. Stop it. Stop it. I'm so sick and tired of seeing people try to sell their used hobby game stuff that is readily available, brand new, in packaging in many stores and locations online for more than retail. It doesn't make sense. Stop trying that hustle. Sorry.
This I'm is disappointed. I thought your final words would have been,
Would they? Would they? No, he's the, God. Mark, can we just take a minute to appreciate Mark Briscoe?
Hell yeah.
We need more Wrestlecasts on this show.
Speaking of Wrestlecasts, if you're watching this live on twitch.tv, first and foremost, hey, how you doing? Good to see you. nice to hear from you, or read from you, I should say. But also, tomorrow, watch AEW Dynamite. It's apparently supposed to be a game changer.
Oh, really?
That's all I'm saying.
Oh, yeah. There's a huge announcement.
There's a huge announcement tomorrow.
A huge announcement? I bet it has to do with the second show.
I bet it has to do with a third show, you dumb dooligan.
I was talking about the second brand. My bad.
No, God, it better not be in a brand split. If it's a brand split,
the 19th show.
The 19th show.
Show. That should be the name of it. The 19th show.
No, it's going to be called CM Punkasaurus. Anyway, my real final word is be kind to each other, will you?
Aww.
Wise words. Aww.
Have a good night, y'all.
Good night, dude.
Take care, Adam. Next game to talk about is Live Alive, developed by Historia Inc. and Square Enix, published by Square Enix, code provided for review by Square Enix.
Thank you, Square Enix.
They like to make sure that we cover those bases. Released April 27th on Steam, PS4, and PS5 for $49.99. Meet seven heroes, each with their own unique abilities and lives across different time periods. Experience their stories in any order you choose, uncovering shocking developments along the way. Purnell, how about you start us off? What is Live Alive?
Live Alive is pretty much the precursor to Saga Frontier. This was originally released on the Super Nintendo back in the age when Square knew how to experiment with things in an interesting and meaningful way. And unfortunately, we didn't receive that release in the States back then. But fortunately, we received it in modern day thanks to this re-release utilizing the Octopath Traveler graphic style, which they created for that game and have been using in a lot of other things since. Well, I see not a lot of things, but enough things. Anyway, what exactly is Live Alive? Well, this game is essentially, like Joe said, seven different narratives that kind of coalesce eventually at a certain point, but of course they should, so don't feel like that's a spoiler. But they eventually coalesce. But up until that point, the individual characters kind of embark on their own individual adventures, each being taking place within a unique timeline, which in of itself. So you have, for example, like the Wild West. You have, I want to say Edo, Japan, but it's...
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
And
Edo you would have, be more appropriate, you know.
Edo!
Edo! Hey, I had this whole conversation about reading it before you heard it pronounced.
Ed's nuts.
I will not... and then you have like the far future and the not so far future, which is kind of funny because the not so far future is probably the present right now. But I digress. And each of these narratives features a character that has their own aspect of which defines them as a character in the game. For example, there's one character whose narrative takes place in the present, and his entire game plays out like a game of Street Fighter 2, where there is no world map exploration, there is no equipping of gear and checking your stats, but instead, you're just battling a bunch of world warriors on a battle screen. And you can steal their attack moves by having them use them against you, and then you can beat the stuffing out of them using the moves you just learned from them, which is actually pretty interesting, but also extremely different from what you'd expect from the norm, being that this is heralded as a JRPG, which technically is, but due to the experimental nature of the beast, you may come at this game and choosing one of the specific characters and going, what the hell am I playing here? Like, for example, my favorite one that I was able to get time with is actually the one I least expected to like, which is the far future character, which plays more like a sci-fi, like horror movie than an actual JRPG. And I was like, at first I was like, where the hell is the combat? It's relegated to a freaking arcade machine that you play all the shit. But then as I kept progressing, I was like, I like this. I don't know what it is, but I think this is really cool. And then you get to the end, and there's actually like one major battle that actually takes place in the game. And then, boom, it's done. And you go, this is the Square I used to love back in the day, back when they were willing to take risks, because quite frankly, they already had the money. But one thing I can say all these have in common, whether it's multiple battles or individual battles, is the battle system itself. In which case you are battling on a grid. I'm going to make up a random bunch of numbers. I want to say it's like a 8x8 grid or something like that. And
it varies depending on the battle.
There we go. And then what ends up happening is enemies will spawn on this battlefield and so will you. I would call this almost a variation of like a roguelike battle system as far as like active time is taken, because as long as you stay still, nothing happens. But every time you take a step, time progresses and the enemy's active gauges will progress ahead as well as yours does. And they will sometimes move as well. So as long as you stay still, you can think for as long as you want. But the moment you take a step, the enemy's active gauges will start to move as well. You can utilize attack skills. And they come in a variety of forms, mostly like types of damage, like blunt or pierce or what have you. But they also have wait durations. So if you use a skill that activates pretty quickly, the time gauge will move accordingly, and you'll do your skill. If you do a long or medium, similar. So if you do a skill that's really powerful but has a long duration, you could probably expect the enemies nearby to get an attack in before your move goes off. But it's worth to use those half the time because the powerful skills are typically pretty freaking powerful. And I kind of like the fact that the game flows pretty freely in that sense. Like, I never really felt like I had to really sit down and strategize what move to use, when to use. It was just more like, okay, this move has a range that goes there. The enemy's going to walk over to that spot. If I can corral him into that zone, I'll have a decent distance away from him, and I can pull off a pretty cool plasma shot. I'm going to freaking do it. And that ends up being how the game flows as far as battles go. If you get party members in that particular character's chapter, well, then the party members can go just as you do. It's like your character gets a turn, then the party member gets a turn, and then you get a turn, then the party member gets a turn. And as you make these choices, the enemies will go based on when the weight gauges move through their time frame. So that's where it comes in as far as like working with multiple characters. I would say, for the most part, the duration of the individual narratives can vary, but none of them that I've gotten through seem to go too long. They're all fairly reasonable in length, but some have like a small world map style where you can explore an area. Some are pretty much just like go from here to there. There's even like a freaking Metal Gear Solid-esque, I love how I said that, because, no, I'm not even going to say Solid, freaking just Metal Gear-esque stealth thing where you're moving through a castle trying to be undetected. And while I do think, I had to look this up because I got pissed off at it, in that the game tells you kill as few people as possible. I'm like, okay, oh, that must be a threshold, right? It's like, no, the threshold is kill nobody. Mm-hmm. You can't kill anybody. And it's like, well, what the fuck is the point of having a counter if killing anybody ruins it? But I spent way too much of my review time seriously trying to do this on my first go without an FAQ, not killing anybody before I just said, fuck it, I can't handle this anymore. It's really, really hard. And the reward is a sword, but I wanted the sword. I wanted to be able to say I did it, but yep. In the end, I just couldn't pull it off with the time I had. So I said, screw it, and walked away.
You get a better sword eventually anyway, so yeah. Spoilers, you know, don't...
You that
know.
Just makes it even worse. Basically, just don't do it.
You can get that good sword like very quickly after like the moment where you can actually use that sword.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
Jesus! So basically, don't do it. Don't do it.
It's fun. I think it's fun to do.
There's a lot of hidden challenges in that game, though, which I really appreciate.
Mm-hmm.
But I can genuinely say, I think I got a feeling you guys are going to agree with this, though, is that I wish Square would do more stuff like this. Maybe make it a little bit more modern, obviously. But the idea of having these like multiple narratives that intertwine, but the individual narratives kind of have a style of their own. So you do kind of feel like you have like multiple mini cool games embedded. Obviously, the risk you'll run is you'll end up with a game where you're like, man, this mode sucked, but that mode was great. I wish they could take the time from that game and dump it into this one. But that's the risk you take when you have fun with experimentation. And that's the kind of thing I like to see. And like I said, considering that I genuinely believe that Saga Frontier likely came from this. I know the Saga series existed in general, but Saga Frontier's playstyle feels a lot like this. Just everybody shares the same world, so having the different time periods. But knowing that that came from this, and as much as I know controversial, love Saga Frontier, well, I owe this game a great debt in that regard, and I am glad it exists. And I had fun playing it, too, seeing how what could have been back in the 90s if it came here in the first place. But what do you guys think of it?
So I think the lineage goes that the team that worked on this then went to work on Chrono Trigger, which to me is also like there's a very clear through line there, and that you actually, you know, you in time travel in Chrono Trigger, and also like the near future character in Live Alive is like a red spiky haired dude, not completely reminiscent of Chrono. But yeah, this game was really cool, like a really cool time capsule packed up in the 90s and sent to us here in the West. If you had not played ROMs or fan translations, which I had not, I figured. But for me, it was like it's a cool, fun game, like on its own. Like, I don't feel like you have to like, well, you know, set your expectations for 25 years ago or 30 years ago or whatever. I think it holds up. I had a great time with it, and it fit really nicely kind of into my life as an RPG, because like those chapters, none of them are longer than like 2.5-3 hours really. I went through that present day like Street Fighter one in like 20-30 minutes. That one was very fast. Yeah, some are like an hour, some are a little bit longer, but it's the kind of thing where it's like, I'm gonna sit down and make progress in this game. Like, you can pretty much get through any of those chapters in a sitting, if not a little bit less. And that felt good. Just like, I'm going to sit down tonight and I'm going to play a chapter. And like some of the longer ones, you might be like, I didn't quite get through this. And they each have something interesting and the U word, unique, about them, because each character has their own abilities and powers, and there's something that makes that chapter stand out. And like you said, you might not like one. I personally despised the prehistoric chapter and loved pretty much everything else. But there was just like one out of seven I didn't like. And then, importantly, like once you've gone through the seven chapters, like there is another chapter, and then there's a chapter where like everything comes together. And that's like a big meaty part of the game, where you have a map and you have a party, and like you have all the characters together, and there's all these like extra dungeons you can do and extra side quests, before you move on to finish the game. Which at that point then feels like, the World of Ruin portion of Final Fantasy VI, where you're going around to find these characters, and then it's just, you know, you can kind of do what you want and go challenge the end of the game once you feel like it. Which is great. It's really cool.
Chris, your thoughts?
Yeah, so I didn't get this one for review. I bought this with my own money. So I also bought this with my own money. Letting Square know that.
I have it on Switch with my own money.
Yeah, I played on Switch last year. Yeah.
I have it on Switch with my own money, but never opened it. So there you go.
Oh, yeah. A surprise.
Well, I did not want to. This time, I didn't want to fall into that trap, and so I did open it, and I played all the way through it, and I played the original as well. This was very nearly my game for 2022, because I really, really enjoyed it.
Whoa, nice.
Yeah, Chained Echoes came in at the last minute and just wowed me into handing it over.
Swooped in there.
It did. It swooped in there.
Rightfully so, too.
Well, yeah, and I mean, it really, it won by virtue of not being a remake of something that's already cool. So yeah. It's kind of like, anyways.
It won by virtue of the Turtle Race music. Let's be honest.
Yeah, pretty much. Anywho's, but I mean, it's that spirit of like that kind of like random awesomeness that that this game really brings. I think that it's and having played a lot of Japanese RPGs, there's a lot that we've missed over here that's like on par with this stuff. Like very cool, experimental, interesting, things that happen. Even the going around a world map but then fighting on a grid, like that's kind of common in games that never made it over here. Mm-hmm. Your Treasure Hunter G or Emerald Dragon or something like that. So it's a style I was already kind of used to. And that's great. I love to play JRPG chess, essentially. I mean, you know, I'm a Shining Force fan, so it's all good there. What I really, 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 really appreciated about this game the most is just what they were able to do with certain things. I know Tim hated the prehistoric era. I like that it told a somewhat complex, if not slightly like cliched story, without using a single word. It's only vocalizations and the occasional emote above a character's. It told a funny story. Like I said, a little bit complex because there's like a little bit of a political situation in Caveman World. Like it's a real story, and they managed to do it without that. I love that the composer for this game is Yoko Shimomura, who is one of the all-time greats of video game music. And get this. She is the one who wrote most of the music for Street Fighter 2 to begin with, so she's doing a parody of herself.
Whoa.
in the present-day Street Fighter thing. I love that it's a better ninja game than most ninja games I've played, like just for one part of it, and that you can fight a giant fish as an optional boss.
Well, I'm sold there.
Yeah, yeah. And like build a ninja robot partner if you want, or just skip it. The game gives you so many little morality choices, and even one of the characters, I'm not going to say which one, one of the characters you can actually change. like you can change their story to where it's different. You can make like you can make a huge choice. Again, not without spoilers, you can make a huge choice towards the end that will change the entire game, if you so desire. Of course, you get all those backup saves so that you can do this without consequence. But yeah, this is a game that like so much thought was put into how, you know, unlike I think your Octopath Traveler or even like a lot of the Romancing Saga or Saga Frontier games. I think a lot of thought was put into, well, this is the premise. How are we going to make this the best experience possible and really tell a whole bunch of like either silly or serious or beautiful, like no matter what they are, like comedy, tragedy or what, like each story is like just beautiful little thing. And it's like it's so worth it to like experience it. And then, like I said, it culminates into like one of the most satisfying like end games I think of anything, and it's all a big secret. Like, don't get yourself spoiled on this one if you can avoid it. Just play through it and let it kind of wash over you. It's great. It's fantastic. It's just like one of those great all-time video game experiences, and I really hope a lot of people check it out.
Wow.
So it sounds like everyone liked this one.
Yeah.
And I will say, really I went on, like I've been on the internet, and like I've seen like a few people talk about it, and they'll make statements like, now, this game was such a disappointment. I wanted a JRPG, and this is not it. Just don't bother. I'm like, listen to those people.
What?
Yeah, I've come across a couple weird of those. People are very weird. Do not listen to those people.
The internet has turned us into monsters.
Yes, it has.
Yeah, it has.
And I mean, I don't know. I kind of, maybe there's a little bit of culpability on Square Enix's part in not doing the thing of like, let's just take a risk and bring this over to the States. Instead, they brought over all the safe games, you know? Like, they knew we'd love some Final Fantasy, which...
Well, it was very late that it actually finally came out, too, so it was kind of like, do we throw out a Super Nintendo game? Eh.
I thought it was 95, but let me see.
Yeah, but like, even that it was...
Oh, 94. This is a Final Fantasy VI. This is before Earthbound and all that stuff, too, so... Yeah, I think 94. This is a great... Like, this definitely screams like 1994 quality.
Well, we could argue about who got it back in the 90s, but we know who's not getting it here in the 2020s, and that's Xbox players.
Well, womp womp.
Womp womp indeed. But this one's sitting at $50 on Steam and PlayStation, also available on the Switch. What does everyone think of it?
Buy it.
Yeah. Buy a physical if you can.
Buy it.
Heck, buy the old one. It's only.
Oh, no, you said specifically buy it physical. But, like, I'm not going to deny that. I agree with buying it physically, but.
Well, is it physical on PlayStation? Did it get a physical release?
I thought it did. Let me check. Heavy sigh. Maybe it didn't.
Because I know it got physical on Switch, but I thought that was more because Nintendo published it. Switch.
Okay. Let me hear well, then game I don't know. Yeah. I can't tell right quick, but yeah.
All right, well, Tim, I guess that is it for you.
Yeah, sleepy time. Yep. It's late.
Thank you, as always, for coming on, doing your thing. Do you have any final words?
No, I'm going to bed. Good night.
You don't want to go, hey, Woodsy.
No. Oh, I know. I could hit something.
Night.
No, yes. I'm just going to leave. Bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, next game to talk about is Paranormasite, The Seven Mysteries of Honjo, developed and published by Square Enix. Code provided for review by Square Enix. Released March 8th on Steam for $19.99. How far would you go to bring someone back from the dead? Discover the depths that some will go in this horror adventure game. Brooke, tell us about your time with Paranormasite.
Yo, may I just begin this review by saying this game is doing a thing, and it is whack. This game opens up and you are greeted by a character wearing a fedora and a trench coat, and he's wearing almost a V for Vendetta style mask as well. He's hanging out next to an old TV set. He's like, welcome to the game, you can call me the storyteller. This game features autosave and we show you this icon, yada yada, but enough about me, what's your name? And you put your name in, you type whatever you want in, obviously, and he says, cool, so your name is blank, am I right? But it's not the name you typed. I am reviewing this game for Steam, and in my version, unless the name you typed in is identical to your Steam username. Like, I was like, my name is Brooke, and I typed that in there. He's like, cool, so your name is Notorious, L-I-N-C-O-L-N, is that right? And I was like, wait, what? Nah. And he's like, oh, my bad. My mistake. You said Brooks. So weird. I don't know why I said that. Anyway, then he explains some other stuff. He's like, here's some more stuff about the game. He said, we're going to be talking about death and resurrection. If you had the power to resurrect someone, would you? And you answer with your choice of a variety of options. You can say, oh, I would for sure. Or I wouldn't use it. Or I would use it if there were no cost. I would use it even if there were a great cost. The answer, no matter what you say, is like, all right, interesting. So we're going to be playing through a few stories here. The first story you're going to be playing as a young college student named Shogo. Let's take a look. And he turns on the TV next to him, and there's some creepy static, and then the news comes on. It's like, unfortunately, today a young student named Shogo was found dead. And the storyteller turns the TV off really quick. He's like, shit, that's spoilers. You're not supposed to see that. Let's just jump into the game. And boom, he goes away. We're Shogo, and the game starts. If you're not familiar with this game, this is an anime game, so these are anime characters. And I may be saying a stretch here by saying it's a Vendetta style mask, but they're definitely trying to do an ominous, almost comical and self-aware thing with this narrator, even from the get-go, even though we don't know what's going on yet. So there are a ton of mystery games out there. We have some every week. There are a ton of scary mystery games out there that offer a range of flavors of horror, jump scare, psychological, environmental, aka unsettling vibes only. There are a shitload of visual novels and point-and-click mysteries out there. So why should you buy Paranormasite? Another anime game, another murder mystery about the nature of death. Why should you hang out in another fictional world where resurrection and thus some form of immortality may be possible for a price? Because you totally should buy Paranormasite, but these things have been done before. It's hard to explain what content-wise really sets this game apart from these categories without giving a lot away. So I'm mostly going to focus on all the different things this game is doing just game-wise, because it is really special. Paranormasite is a really incredible piece, and playing this game as a fan of visual novels and mystery games, within about 2 hours, I was thinking, I didn't know the price of it. I was thinking this is easily a $60 game in the USA. I mean, if you could date the anime characters in it, it sure would be, hey, Dasanatome. But seriously, I was astounded about how many different things this game is doing that push it so far over the mark that even though I love visual novels maybe more than anything, I gotta say, I think this game barely counts as one. It's much more than a standard visual novel or a point-and-click mystery game. Quality of writing, both intricate, actual working, branching plots that aren't just phoned in saying that it's like a choose your own adventure when it's really not. You're going to end up at the same places. They've got that down. Atmosphere, setting, A+. Very high quality art. The character designer for this game is Jin Kobayashi. He worked on Nioh, World Ends With You, Kingdom Hearts, Resident Evil, all kinds of stuff. And the art's just immaculate here. So that's sound design and UI, all impeccable and really stylish, like almost Bustafellos level UI niceness. So that's great, but let's jump into mechanics here. Visual novels, but many point-and-click mysteries. You at many points throughout the game examine a scene for clues, creepy hiding, dudes, vibes, items you can put into your inventory for later. But the scene you examine isn't just the screen on your monitor you look at when the scene pops up in this game. You can move left, right, up, down to look around that view, because this game gives you a 360 degrees view of each scene you're examining. For the life of me, I've never seen this before. You can even look like up and down. So maybe it's more than 360 degrees, and then I don't even know the term for that. If I hadn't seen it here first, I wouldn't have even known how much I liked it. Maybe they just executed this idea super well, but I adored this feature. I found it super, super immersive.
I was actually looking to see if it was a VR game in any way, but it's not. So
I almost would think that, looking at like a trailer, if I wasn't paying attention. And sometimes I don't like too much motion or whatever. I actually struggle with motion sickness, so I can't do all VR stuff yet. I'm working on it. But this game was really smooth, and it's not like you quickly click around and the view changes so much you get dizzy. Like this is very well made here in these scenes. And it's cool because that you have this 360 degree view and all these options, because as in all the best mystery games, there's more than one way to skin a cat. Joe, sorry, I know that was a little graphic to you. There's more than one way to pet a rabbit in this game. There are multiple ways to solve a lot of the little mini mysteries and mega mysteries that connect in this game, a lot of different avenues you can take to get where you're going. And while some parts of the game are a bit linear briefly, please know there's a lot of different endings for this game, a lot of ways to get to those. And I took a peek at the plot map for this game where all the chapters and options are laid out when I got really far into it. And I gotta say, I'm impressed. This is definitely more fleshed out and structured than the vast majority of branching plots with multiple ending visual novel type games I've played, of which y'all know I played a whole lot. Going back to the 360 view scenes, that means there's lots of stuff scattered across this game to find in these scenes. It's not mandatory. There's even collectible stickers and stuff to find if you're into it, and if you're ever frustrated by a point-and-click mystery game being so linear and locking you into having to find or make the one inventory item to interact with that one weird thing you need to keep the story going, that's probably actually just not going to happen to you in this game. It's also just a scary, immersive tool that we use because you're looking around and maybe while you look around, something came up behind you and you turn around and things might not be how you left them, and it really follows your view. But something like that, yeah, it can happen to you in this game. Since your choices matter so much, you can also die. Like in real life, there are many opportunities to die. And because of the nature of this game, you can only have one save at a time. But if you die like a couple times to a few times at certain parts and you're getting a little stuck, the game will give you a hint. But the hint will never give anything away, which I think that's hard to pull off. If you know me, you know I really, 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 really appreciate all of that. If you don't know me, here's why. I like to play cerebral mystery games, and I love to solve the little mystery, but I am naturally not very observant, or have a good memory, or very good critical thinking skills. This is why I'm not a detective in real life, and I instead choose to play games. However, I don't play these games to feel observant, or smart, or cool, or good-looking, or whatever have you. I play these games like I play my other little baby games that I love, to be immersed, to have the mysterious experience. I want to RP this out, like, in my mind, man. I want to be the main character. I want to live in that world. Unless I constantly spend 2 hours in a game, I can stay really immersed. Unless I constantly spend, like, 2 hours in a game looking for the stupid answer to something, and I've dealt with the fact that sometimes the game's a little too smart for me, and now I gotta, like, tab out or pull up my phone all the damn time to get on some blog or some site, watch a YouTube video to walk me through it. I'm always like, don't interrupt my vibes by making the game too hard, man. And yet I know this is a me problem, and I don't want my games to be too easy where they're not fun. So it's an interesting problem to have, and I don't blame game devs for not giving me just the right level of game for me. But I super, super appreciate when game devs give us a challenging, immersive experience and somehow tailor that so well with features like multiple ways to solve or classy hints if I die too much. And that's what these devs have given us. So devs, if you're listening to this, you're really wonderful. You guys are really cool. I know I've already talked a lot already because I'm trying to do something a little different in this review and talk features of the game. I want to talk about a couple more. I'll cut this thing short because I think we can tell what kind of rating I want to give this game. There are tons of immersive mini games in this game, but they don't interrupt anything or break up the story. They pull you in more. If you played a point-and-click mystery game and it's like, cool, now jump into this minigame we designed to show off that this is a multifaceted game, that could pull you out really quick. So I think it's a deft hand that can put that sort of thing in there and sort of push and pull you around without bringing you out of it. There's a Ouija board type thing you can use with one of the characters in the game. It's made out of paper and a coin. That doesn't sound like it looks great, but it looks really great. The assets of this game are ridiculously nice. Personally, please don't get mad at me, Purnell. I like this art style a little bit better than the Persona art style. Although it's hard to compare to it. And I do want to mention to Persona fans out there, if you like that franchise and you want to play more games like that are anime games, choices matter, fleshed out plot-wise like that, that have a really good idea connecting them, and you're not married to having a combat system or dungeons, you may want to try this game. If you're a Phoenix Wright fan... Dude, Purnell, I'm so sorry, man. If you're a Phoenix Wright fan... He's so mad right now. You can hear it in his voice. Nah, you're also. How dare you? I adore the Persona games, though, so I'm not trying to say I like this game better than those games.
I'm just messing with you.
But it's well deserved. If you're a Phoenix Wright fan, too, you can also appreciate, in addition to Phoenix Wright type stuff, some spooky, unsettling horror with heavy dark themes. I would try this game out, too. Insane value for you. Atome fans. Y'all thought I forgot about you. Nah, you know I didn't. You can't date the hot anime guys in this game, but you still need to play this game. I will be watching. Y'all would appreciate this one. This game is reading heavy, and it's not all voiced, although it still feels like a really big budget game and it has a lot of voice acting in it. So it's a great fit, but it's also a great fit for other fans too, because this game and its characters really care about if you've been paying attention to what you're reading. And you realize how big that is in this game really quick, and you're like me, that gives you kind of like a thrilling reason to pay close attention to the details, even in dialogue, and not just skip through text because you don't trust the creators to kind of make it worth your while. This game just doesn't feel like it has any filler. The characters in this game are phenomenally fleshed out. Don't base your opinions on the characters and their development through this game on trailers, reviews, wiki pages. Even if someone writes a review that starts with someone saying, the guy had a V for Vendetta mask. Like, don't make any assumptions, because some characters seem like they're doing an anime trope thing at times, and they are on a surface level, but I will assure you this game and its character creation is incredibly self-aware in many departments, including that one. So even if you think you see a transparent anime trope, there's a reason for everything in this game. People who liked L.A. Noire and couldn't shut up about it for 2 years after you tried it. I'm holding up an ornate hand mirror and looking into my own eyes as I say this. You may enjoy this game. This game's not jump scary. Someone's hijacking
a car outside, by the way.
Yeah, unfortunately, someone is... Okay, cool. It stopped. The car has been stolen, and everything
good.
Is fine.
Good.
That will teach you to have a car around here. But yeah, this game is... I like that y'all can see that. I didn't know you could hear the car alarms in the background. That's pretty funny to me.
It is the national anthem of people who live in apartments.
Yeah.
No matter where you are. Every day and night. What the hell?
Yeah, I almost I didn't even notice it was happening because it's just white noise to me at this point until you guys said it. And then I was like, LOL, who had their mic on? Oh, no, it's me. Yeah, this game is not a jump. Solid gold. The game is not jump scary, heavy, but there is some slight stuff that kind of feels a little jump scary at times. If you hate that, as my partner does, I'm going to tell you what I told my partner before we started recording the show tonight. I don't care what you like. Get over there and play this. I'm just kidding. This game is unsettling at times and bad for the heart. So if you're really easily spooked, you know, don't do it if stuff like that ruins your day. But I will
caveat.
I don't like
scary stuff. Well, you can shut the fuck up and play the game anyway.
Come on, sit down. I'm going to be watching. There will be a test. But yeah, I would bring this up because I want to caveat that even if you don't like jump scares, if the reason you don't like games that at times use intense environmental horror like that because you think it's a cheap shot and the games just don't make it worth it to you with content outside of those tools to back it up, I think this game could still be worth it for you. I think we've all played our share of horror games where we're sort of like, besides jump scares, what else does this have going on? You know, this game's going to use that very, very sparingly if it uses it at all. And in my opinion, only kind of final reason I think this game is worth it, the endings. If you're into mystery games or mystery films, fiction, Otome, whatever, then you're probably sad when you get deep enough into a mystery or to the end of it and you start to realize, man, this mystery wasn't totally fleshed out like, solution wise like the ending feels phoned in. The idea of multiple endings to a lot of games like this feels forced, so we can just say that we have multiple endings, which always sucks. This game rewards those who finish it, and it rewards those who finish it multiple times to try to really figure out its little universe for themselves. This game's built around not only its ideas but how it finishes those ideas. It's built around the endings, in my opinion, which I personally believe all truly genius mysteries have to be. This one pays off even if you don't get to its ultimate quote-unquote true finale ending, because I think it's just a fun, immersive game. And if any of this means anything to you and you've experienced that in these spaces, Otome and Mari fans looking at you one more time, you know how big of a deal that really is for a mystery to have a good ending, especially if you're going to dump, 20, 30 hours into a game. Pretty good.
Cool. Well, the game is sitting at $20, which I personally found kind of shocking. Square is known for having more expensive games, and to see something at only $20, kind of a nice surprise from them. So what do you think?
Well, like I said, when I got a couple hours in this game, I was like, is this a $60 game? I'm going to look this up. And then I saw the price and I was like, oh, are the endings going to suck? Like, what's the downside here? Like, oh, is it going to kind of drop off and like Neon Genesis Us, where everything is everything? That didn't happen to me, so I don't understand why this game's so cheap. So I'm going to, let me talk back over my notes here. I'm going to call this game a buy it unless you're Aki.
Why unless you're me?
I'm glad you asked, Aki, because Aki, when you get something that can play this game, I'm buying it for you because I think you should have this, and I think you personally would really love this.
Well, I can't argue with that.
I'm so glad you were here, too. So I was like, sorry,
I do want to point one thing out because I have to be that girl. Okay. It's not a V for Vendetta mask, it's a Guy Fawkes mask.
Okay, see, and I did, at least I admitted that I may not know what I'm talking about there, so I can always hide back under that. So that's a better, I don't actually know who that is, but that's a better description.
Yeah.
for sure.
We can talk about that after the show. I can explain that. It's very simple, and we can use V for Vendetta to explain it very easily.
Okay, sweet.
Cool. All right. Well, Brooke, that is it for you. You going to stick around, or are you heading out?
I'm not. I'm going to figure out what pizza I'm going to get tonight. It's not going to have it.
Delicious.
I gotta find some pizza now. But I hope y'all have a wonderful evening. I will see you next week.
You too. Nighty night, Brooke.
Have a good
night. Later.
Bye.
All right, Aki, what are you doing? You sticking around, or are you heading out?
I'm sticking around.
Cool. Next game to talk about, Dokapon Kingdom Connect, developed by Sting, Compile Heart, and Idea Factory, published by Idea Factory International. Released May 9th on the Switch for $49.99. Adventure for Money begins where absolutely anything goes. Everyone in Dokapon Kingdom loves money. Chris and Purnell, you guys played this together. What do you think?
You want me to start?
Yes, please.
Okay, so this is Dokapon Kingdom Connect. This is a remake of a remake. So Dokapon Kingdom is a later game in the series that started on the Super Nintendo. Well, not the Super Nintendo, the Super Famicom. It's a remake of the second game, which is Dokapon 3-2 Wanarashi Yoyobuyoju.
Want to run that bias one more time?
Dokapon 321 Arashi Oyobu Yujo. I don't know if that's the proper pronunciation, but it seems like it is. Anyway, it was a board game RPG hybrid series that, like I said, is there's a tagline on one of the games that says "From Friendship to Mayhem." So that's kind of how it goes. So it's a long-running series, and we've only gotten a couple of them over here in the United States. Mostly, the largest concentration was around the 2008-ish era, where we got Dokapon Kingdom for the PS2 and the Wii, Dokapon Journey for the DS, although there is there's a Dokapon Gaiden, they called it Monster Hunter. And it came out on the Game Boy Advance, and over here it's just called Dokapon. That has nothing to do with any of this. I just like to brag because I own that one too. Mostly we got the DS, PS2, and Wii games, and the PS2 and Wii games, this is a straight up, a polished up, internet connected version of that game. So the main thrust of Dokapon Kingdom is that you are, however many players, you can share a single controller, it's that kind of game, or assigned controllers, or, whole Switches in this case, because, it's online connected, but you can do, any combination of human and computer players up to four. Computer players have their own difficulty settings that you can set. All the characters can be customized into different colors and different jobs. So the jobs will determine what your stat growth is going to look like as you level up throughout the game. Fighters gain more attack and defense, automatically. And then, of course, you get bonus points that you can dump in there, too. Thieves get speed. Magicians get magic. That's just how it goes. And so basically the goal of it is to get as strong as you can and earn a whole bunch of money. The way you earn money is twofold. One is that you go around this game board. It's very much like a sprawling world map that has whole countries that, you will be kind of level locked out of. You kind of determine at the beginning what you want your game length to be, usually in weeks. Every time every player gets a turn, that's a day. And then at the end of the week, everybody's ranked against each other. And then, whoever's the winner at the end of that is the winner. There's also a quest, an entire story mode to play through that features special challenges and is a full length RPG length. So that's one that you are most likely going to be tackling by yourself. You basically move around the board through a throw of the dice, or rather a turn of the spinner. There are spinners that determine, 0 through 6, how many spaces you get to move, no more, no less. And on the actual board, our you know, weapon shops, item shops, empty spaces, which will, you know, either turn into a battle or an encounter with a different kind of NPC that may screw you over royally or benefit you highly, at the, usually at the expense of the other players, because that's what, that's the whole point of this game, which we'll get to. Or you could land on a town, and the towns all start off being taken over by ugly monsters. The monsters are especially tough for that region, and so if you can beat that monster, you get to take over that town, which adds to your intrinsic worth. That is to say, it's not money you have in your pockets, but it's money that you are worth, and it counts towards your rank. And then, you know, every time you win a fight, or, you know, through whatever other happenstance, you win money that actually is in your pocket, and that can go towards items, weapons, bribing, hiring assassins. Money can go all kinds of ways, usually out the window, due to, again, some random chance. Okay, Pernell, go.
Oh, where?
I don't know. I got tired of talking.
Well, Dokapon Kingdom, as far as the mechanics go, I can't really follow up as say more than what he said, but what I will say in the general sense of the game is that it is, at its general core, a roll and move type game, as in you spend the spinner, get a number, go to a place. And if that's not your cup of tea on the surface, and you're a real stickler for it, then this game may not change your mind. However, if you're willing to give it a bit of a bright-eyed shot, because you're willing to see if there might be a little something deeper in there than just roll and move or spin and move, well, I do believe this game has that flair, because I'm not at the surface typically one for a roll and move game either, but there's like this weird aspect of the competitive, the competitiveness of this game that just makes it extra fun. The fact that you can have a character decked out with an extremely high attack power, but still lose to a Rochambeau battle in a battle because you just chose the wrong symbol. The fact that there is a mechanic in the game where if you fall too far behind, you can actively go to a place and give up everything you possess just to make the game awful for everyone else playing the game. Yes. That sounds like it would be a bad time, but in this game, that is freaking amazing. It's just, it's great. It's a joy to play. I mean, admittedly, I will say that the people you play with will make all the difference, though. Because you want to be talking about what you're doing. You will want to talk about, oh man, you stole my shit. Like, you need to have those kinds of interactions. And if you're going to be straight-faced about it, you'll lose a lot of what makes the game special. I also remember correctly, depending on what happens, let's say, for example, you attack another player and you lose, the other player can change your in-game character's name to something terrible. And then you have to run around the whole game with that terrible name until you pay someone later to change it for you or something.
They can also give they can also mess up your hair, give you a poop haircut.
Oh, that's right. I had the poop haircut, and every time I had to turn to spin the wheel, it made like a weird like fart sound. Like, God damn it! but like, there's just like extra special levels of silliness to the game that adds to the experience, so long as you're willing to let yourself fall into it. If you're not willing to do that, you lose a lot of what makes Dokapon special. I bought this game on the original Wii. I bought it on here and kept it despite the fact that the review code came while I had time to cancel my order. I knew I wanted it, so I was like, I'm still going to get it. I don't give a damn. I'm just going to be able to talk about it on a show, too. Dokapon is great, and this game, I don't know what more they added beyond the online, but I feel like the online is all you really need to make it worth it. Hell, if it weren't for the online, I would have been able to play it with Chris and Catherine. So,
I was going to say, that's one of the big things with this new release, is that it does have online play, and Idea Factory was awesome enough to send us a handful of codes. You two played with Catherine. Chris, how did that go? How did the three of you playing go?
Went excellently as far as playing it goes. I was the one who messed it up by trying to get it streaming on Discord, and it turns out that's more complicated than I thought. But, you know, we all got into Discord chat and talked to each other while we were playing it, all on our respective Wiis. What am I saying? Switches. And, it was a good time. We didn't get all the way through a 10-week campaign, but it definitely started. Funny enough, we all three picked thief classes, which was weird, because it the game doesn't tell you what the other person's picking while you're doing character creation. However, when the other player is doing all their moves, of course you see their moves on your screen and stuff. So, you know, you always there's no hiding anything from any other players. Like if you're trying to screw somebody over, you are on full display that way. And so, yeah, there's a little bit of a psychology behind behind the competitiveness of this game. And I started off as a very early favorite, and then Purnell just completely swept up due to some, like, you know, just the kind of
masterful gameplay.
Yes, through your masterful gameplay. And so, yeah, I ended up in a pretty weak third, even though I had a strong first. So, like, that's just kind of the way the game goes. You can never stay committed to thinking you're going to be on the top or the bottom for very long, because eventually the game will find its way to even you out and make everybody else mad. Although I will say Purnell pretty much had that poop haircut for the entire game.
And the funny part is, like, it got to the point where I didn't want to lose. I was like, yeah, everybody knows the Stink Master's coming. That's right. Give me that money.
Yeah, incorporated into the brand.
Go to the dojo. Oh, no, Poop Master.
It played super well. It didn't drop any kind of frames. It didn't give us any kind of issues. Like I said, you know, we were playing far apart and also, you know, from across the room. So, like, that was really cool. Yeah, it's a solid multiplayer, like, online game. Obviously, you're going to want some alternative way to shit talk each other, because, you know, the game's not going to feature any kind of real communication between players. So,
but also worth noting, too, when we played it, one of the most important features, in my opinion, to the online is whether or not you can stop and resume later. And fortunately, you can. You can stop your game. It'll save everyone's state in the game, and you can all get back together, boot the game up, and resume where you left off.
Yeah, that is really important. And it separates your online and offline save data. So you have a whole different set of, like, offline data if you're playing, like, your own single-player game or local multiplayer.
That's good.
So, yeah. I thought they did a really good job in, like, incorporating. And, you know, like I said, it's hard to complain about them not really adding any content, because I don't think they did. I think it's really pretty much the exact same game that was on the Wii and PS2. But here's the thing about those games. They're freaking expensive now, like hundreds of dollars. So this is your way.
On the Wii?
Yeah, the Wii one. I just saw it at our local retro place for $350, I think.
Jeez.
Holy butter snatch.
Yeah. I was lucky enough to get it, and I groused a little bit over having to pay $40 for it, but, you know.
Well, I knew I wanted it. I see one on eBay for $90, so I think the $350 price is a bit crazy.
Yeah, it might just be because it's, like, a complete in-box, and probably, you know, then that store is, like, kind of going nuts anyway, so. Yeah. But, you know, it can get up there.
No, this one's only $50, so what do you think?
God, man, I think it's a buy it. Just understand that this is one of the preeminent friendship destroying games.
Absolutely.
You really, really got to have, like, respect for the fact that, you know, you can separate being very fond of somebody with having them just absolutely screwing you over at every opportunity, because this game not only encourages it, it pretty much requires that you, like, that the way to get ahead is to screw over your other fellow players. And, you know, that's the experience whether you play this with other people or not, because you could set the computer as easy as you like. They're still, like, if you get ahead of them, they're going to dump every spell and item they've got in their whole, like, catalog right on top of your head. And
the guy in that game is actually surprisingly good.
Yeah. Oh, and another thing just to note, because this is something that kind of changes from game to game. I've actually played several of the Dokupon games thanks to fan translations. But in this one, you cannot save scum and get a different role. If you, like, you know, roll a 5 or whatever, and you're like, oh, I don't want a 5, that's going to put me in a bad place. So, you know, you reload like you just saved it or something, it's going to roll you a 5 the next time anyway, so. Mm. And now you can decide a different thing to do with that 5, but just letting y'all know, in the single-player mode with the save scumming, it's not as cool as Journey, where, like, Dokupon Journey on DS would let you just, like, you know, things could turn out completely different. Oh yeah, what am I saying? It's a buy it. Forgot we were at that part.
Yeah, Purnell?
Absolutely. I mean, I literally bought it. So, yes, it's a buy.
Buy it and play it with us. Just let us know.
There you go. Jump in our Discord and play with us.
Yeah. So. I may, once I figure out how to stream it, I may have to host something like that sometime.
That could be pretty fun.
Because it's fun to watch. It's fun to watch people screw each other over, too.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Who wants some poop hair?
Anyway, next game to talk about is Monster Hunter Rise Sunbreak, developed and published by Capcom, released April 25th on Xbox One, Series X and S, PS4, and PS5 as DLC for Monster Hunter Rise for $39.99. Renowned as the fierce flame of Kimura since the events of Monster Hunter Rise, you must set sail to uncover the cause of a terrible threat facing a kingdom across the sea. Brunel, tell us about your time spent with Monster Hunter Rise, and I don't know if I got to any of the Sunbreak content, because there's just much in this game. But
I feel remiss.
Monster Hunter Rise.
I will say, I'll be remiss to say that I feel like I would have had to make this a full-time job to have gotten to the DLC part in the time we had, considering how long it took me to do it in Monster Hunter World. But with that said, I am pretty confident that I am going to enjoy the Sunbreak DLC, because I did read about what it provides, and it's very similar to the previous DLCs and games like Monster Hunter World, in that it gives you like higher rank missions with new tiers of monsters. It also provides you with a new buddy system where you can get like human companions that will join you on missions in single player mode, which is pretty nice when you want a reliable partner that's not a freaking palico or your dog to fight battles with you. But
as nothing far is as wrong Monster with Hunter, palico potato.
Hey, he's cool to find items, but he ain't winning you no battles. I can tell you that much.
She potato is a girl.
Doesn't matter. Ain't winning you no battles.
Potato is the best.
But as far as the game goes, it's interesting to say, because I bought Monster Hunter Rise when it originally released on the Nintendo Switch, because I told myself I'd be really ecstatic to have multiplayer availability. Not multiplayer, sorry, portability on the game, having come from Monster Hunter World, which I put like 200 hours into, which for me is a lot. And lo and behold,
I think for anyone, 200 hours is a lot.
Yeah, but in the world of Monster Hunter, depends on the game. Baby cakes. In Monster Hunter, people put way more than that.
True.
But as far as that goes, like the funny part is, like when I bought that, I didn't bother with it. Like I tried to boot it up multiple times and I couldn't get into it. At first, I thought it was because maybe the game was just inferior to Monster Hunter World or something, or that maybe it just was too complicated. Monster Hunter World made things just simple enough. So, fun fact, I ended up getting into this one quite a bit. Turns out I like Monster Hunter Rise a lot. I just needed the right atmosphere to play it on, being a freaking console with on my TV that has the same vibe that World gave me. Maybe I'm just locked into that feeling. But what this game does is, in typical Monster Hunter fashion, you are a member of a community. This community features a number of people who are trained in hunting monsters because they choose to live in a place that has been is still overrun by nature, and rather than leave it well enough alone, they go murder everything and then wear the components as clothing. But you are that hunter, up and comer, who becomes hero of time, and the gameplay revolves around you taking on missions and going out into the wild to hunt these creatures. The hunt consists of you taking on Palico, that we described earlier, that's a little cat person. Dog character, which is pretty awesome, because not only will they help you out, but you can ride them, which helps you get around much faster than just running around. And you have to worry about a stamina meter while you're riding the dog, which I tell you right now is a wonderful, wonderful thing. I love having the dog to get around on the map. And then when you also get to choose as one of a multitude of weapon types, they all perform very differently. And though the Monster Hunter community will tell you that there are best and worst weapons, in my personal opinion, you can win any battle with any weapon so long as you're comfortable using it and you can play well with it. There's no bad weapon in this game, just one you like the most or least. They do come in like easy mode weapons like the dual blades and the sword and the shield, and then advanced weapons like the insect glaive. So just play around with it and disturb what you want. There's like a cool little like in-game manual that explains what the move types are. So I wish the game had like a physical like tutorial like World did, where he actually showed you dummies and gave you the button inputs. But in addition to that, you can take your new weapon and you can take equipment, which is armor, you know, helmet, pants, and some trinkets. I'll talk about that stuff in a second, because before I go on to what those things can really do for you, I got to talk about what the actual hunt consists of, which is on a level, you'll come across a variety of endemic life. Might be just like random animals that exist in the region, berries you can pick, items you can just scavenge for, all of which have a multitude of uses, ranging from like crafting healing items or traps or take back for quest items. But the most important thing you're going to be doing in these locations is hunting monsters that you've been sent there to hunt by choice of mission. Monsters range from small, medium to large, and oh my fucking god, get away from me. monsters can be pretty terrifying in these games. They are not meant to be beaten quickly. They are actively engaged contests of will in a number of cases, especially as you get further into the game, because enemies will be aggressive. Sometimes they'll have stick. Monsters have a variety of behavioral styles. Some are extremely aggressive. Some will do like a bit of a stick and move. Some will stay airborne and come down at odd times, thereby frustrating the crap out of you. But they all kind of play in a way where you need to be a little bit specific about how you want to engage them and take them down. While you are fighting them, you will be trying to break off parts of their bodies by having the proper weapon type to do it with sometimes. Like, for example, if you want to chop off a monster's tail, you want to have a bladed weapon to do so. Whereas if you want to break the snout off of his face, you need a hammer or a blunt object to do that. Because doing that, as well as ultimately killing the monster, will net you a bunch of monster parts. You take those monster parts back to town, and you can use them to craft yourself a variety of weapons and armor. It takes a while, if you've never played a Monster Hunter game, to get used to the actual purpose for crafting equipment. Because on the surface, you might find yourself thinking, well, yeah, I just want higher defense numbers, because that's what typically happens in these games. But in addition to defense, there are also character traits and perks that you can obtain by getting a variety of buffs, stat ups in that category, which will be presented to you by the armor bits. Random example, you might have a helmet that gives you healing, paralysis resistance, right? It has a rating of 1, and then the armor has a rating of 2 for that, and then the shoes that you find will have another rating of 1. Well, if you combine all those pieces of equipment, you'll have paralysis resistance level 4, which means you're going to be really good at avoiding paralysis from monsters that inflict that upon you. And there's a ton of different skills in this game, and building the correct model for the type of monster you are hunting is a major part of what makes this game something else. Like, there's a lot of preparatory work, creating gear, upgrading the gear, matching it to the mission you want, and of course, if you're also into that, straight up fashion. What looks cool? I don't even care what buffs it gives me. I just want to look awesome in my freaking fishnet stockings and helmet. You can do that if you find the gear. So there's this interesting rudimentary loop that comes out of that. Just the going in, going in, going out, going in, going out, and taking on new monsters and accessing new areas, which has more new monsters. You might come into an area where now you suddenly have to be concerned about the temperature. Got to keep your temperature levels right so you don't freeze to death out in the woods. That kind of stuff happens in these games. But one other thing that I really like about this game that the previous one I had played, World, did not have, is the wire bug mechanic. The wire bugs bring two really interesting things to this game that World did not have. One being world traversal abilities. So you are given the opportunity to use wire bugs to, say, launch yourself in a variety of directions. Now, you're not flying around the map like freaking Superman, but you will find yourself being able to use wire bugs to launch yourself vertically, like diagonally upwards into a wall, and then you can run up the wall to finish your trek. Get you up there, just nippy, sippy, skippy. You might find yourself just wanting to straight up dodge an enemy. So you'll launch yourself straight up as they're running towards you. Now you're above the monster, and you're coming down to stab it in the back of the head. Cool things like that. But in addition to the dodging and maneuverability, wire bugs also introduced new special attacks that the weapons give you. And I felt that was a big thing that was missing from the previous game, because it's cool to be able to say, I specialize in this weapon, And with this weapon, these are the special moves that I prefer to use. You actually burn a wire bug to implement them, but depending on if you pull it off correctly, you will do a crap ton of damage on an enemy and look pretty freaking cool while doing it. I adore the skill system in this game, and I like the fact that you can learn new skills by performing certain feats and expanding your repertoire even further and giving yourself a personal customization aspect to this game. It is a time sink, though, as you can clearly tell by the fact that I'm here talking about Sunbreak and never got the Sunbreak. but it's a fun time sink, especially if you can get around to playing it with friends. You can go online, bring friends on. You can do story missions. You can do actual missions specifically tailored towards having multiple friends online to play them with. They might give you like some complicated matters like having to hunt two or three monsters at the same freaking time, which means sometimes they might actually meet up in the wild and have like a freaking turf war, and you got to figure out how to engage that turf war. There's a lot of cool stuff here. It's a lot of fun to play.
Sometimes you get them in the same area and they start fighting each other, and you just get to recover and, you know, use a whetstone and get your blade sharp again and pop a potion and just enjoy the view for a minute or two while they focus on each other.
Absolutely. Those turf wars are wonderful. And, like, sometimes you might see them wrap up the turf war. One slings off in one direction, the other goes in the other, and you walk up to where they fought, and the monster broke parts off for you. So you just start scraping them off the ground, like, thanks, yeah, chump. Like, it's a really nice vibe there. Like, the Monster Hunter franchise has been running for a ridiculously long time. Like, the first one I bought was, like, Monster Hunter Freedom Unite on the PSP way back in the day. Though it took until Monster Hunter 3 Ultimate for me to go, now I see why this game is so popular. But I mean, the gameplay loop hasn't changed all that much over the course of over a decade, but the games remain fun, and Monster Hunter Rise is no exception to that. I would say the only thing that might stop people from really diving into this game is the fact that there is like some preparatory work and understanding that goes into playing the game. There's a learning curve if you've never played a Monster Hunter game before. And in addition to that, if you look at screenshots and like imagery, the game seems like extremely action-packed, just like lightning dashes and smashes. It is really not. The combat in this game is fairly meticulous, too, in the sense that, you know, all the swings you make are deliberate. The enemy, you can't just go up to a monster and just like rail your attack button, because if you do, the monster's going to beat the crap out of you. You have to be smart about when you hit enemies, when to back off, when to leave bait for them to get suckered, you can sneak up on them and beat them down. There's a lot at play here, but if you're willing to give that a shot like I did way back in the day when I originally wanted an action game and this wasn't it, I came away realizing that this is not action, but what it is something that I also really enjoy. I wholeheartedly recommend Monster Hunter Rise, and I know what I'm going to be getting from Sunbreak, and I'm ready to get it. In fact, the only reason I didn't buy Sunbreak on the Switch was because, one, I hadn't gotten that far into the game yet, because, like I said earlier, and it takes 10 gigs on my already full terabyte card. It was a very hard choice. So being able to play it on Xbox is like easy peasy. Yeah, I don't have to worry about hard drive space there. Gimme. So
Something else to keep in mind is that you get some bonus equipment if you pick up the expansion that will, if you're still new in the game, it will help you big time. The armor that you get is incredibly useful. It has saved my ass in countless battles. In a normal fight, you'll take like 2-3 hits and you're down in potions. With this armor, I was doing full battles without healing.
That is a good thing, though. I will say this about the armor.
It's good starter armor. It's obviously you're going to replace it over time, but it's good. It is so helpful to start with.
Like, I'm not even saying that. I'm saying, because I agree with you. It's very good armor. But if I had never played this before, the armor is good when you want to just move the heck on. But you want to play with the base stuff you got at least for a bit, because you need to learn how to take the hits and how to do the maneuvering, because when you get to the later part of the game, when it's being really mean and you've gotten used to being buffed up and now you're not anymore because the armor's been outclassed, I think that will yield more frustration than if you just took your licks early and then just built yourself up. So if you're new to the game, use that extra special armor as something that just says, okay, I'm tired of fighting this thing, time to just move on. But otherwise, yeah, learn the curve, get the ropes down before you move on to, like, you know, broken goods. You'll thank yourself later.
All right, well, let's see. How can we rate this? Monster Hunter Rise itself is available for $39.99. Monster Hunter Rise Sunbreak, which is DLC, is $39.99. You can get both of them together for $69.99. There's also deluxe editions that you could get with bonus content. I believe the $69.99 is the deluxe version. The standard version is $59.99. That includes the game and the expansion pass. And on top of that, it's on Game Pass. So if you're not sure you want to buy it, you could play it on Game Pass. Or if you do want to buy it, you get 20% off. So you could pay $48 and get everything. The game and the expansion pass. Not all the extra bonus, but like the game and the expansion for $48. I think that's a hell of a deal if you've got Game Pass and the discount.
It is, though. With Monster Hunter, it's a weird vibe to give off in the sense that I still want to say, like, due to the amount of time just the base game will likely take you, if you are not certain you're going to commit, like, actually get down to business, just get the base game and then get the expansion later, because it'll still be there and it'll still be fun. But I feel like the discount doesn't justify the means in the case, because the base game gives you so freaking much. You might not be that type of player that's going to say, okay, I just battled for like 100 plus hours, time to do the DLC. You might be like, well, I had my fun, I'm moving on. And now you have this entire DLC doing nothing for you. But with that said, if you get to the point where you're actually like at the end game of the base game, you're going to like the DLC. So at which point, then you just go online and buy it anyway. Hell, it might be on sale at that point. It might be on a different sale. Yeah. So I recommend all of it, but I err on the side of caution in this case. This isn't like a 10-hour game and then the DLC adds another 20. This is literally like a 100-hour game.
And it adds hundreds of hours.
Yeah, you'll be spending some time here, so you may as well pace yourself.
No. If nothing else, play it on Game Pass, because it's there.
Like Monster Hunter Rise on Game Pass. And then don't they do that thing where if a game starts to come off of Game Pass, they give you like a final extra special deal or something?
No, that's like sometimes games will go on an extra sale if it's coming off Game Pass, but there's no official like when it comes, like it's just 20% off, 10 to 20.
Oh, okay, well 20% off is still pretty freaking good, so. Yeah.
All right, next up is Paws of Cold, developed and published by GameChuck. Released May 1st on Steam for $4.99. See, we're keeping up with the expensive games here. The miners of Rabbit Burrows are falling ill and it's hurting production. And as an eminent scholar of the animal kingdom, Charles Quill has been summoned by the Crown to help them solve the outbreak. The miners know and respect the young scholar, but there seem to be other things at play. Chris, what is going on in Paws of Coal?
Okay, so Paws of Coal is kind of a walkabout detective game. So you play as Charles. You're a hedgehog, who is tasked with finding out why a bunch of rabbits are getting sick. These rabbits live underground in a mining town.
Charles and, the non-blue hedgehog. It's Charles the non-blue hedgehog.
And, you know, actually, that's funny you should bring that up, because I was going to say that this is probably among the slower games that star a hedgehog as the main character. But that's okay. It's totally in keeping with the way the game is played. So, yeah, the scene opens up with you speaking with a doctor, and the doctor has a patient who is suffering from hallucinations, abdominal tightness, and you know, just in a bad state, discoloration and things like that. And you're asked to diagnose the patient using the information that you find from a book on a nearby desk. This is the game's way of kind of tutorializing you into knowing what it's all about. And that is that you start a dialogue tree, or you know, a dialogue sequence, or like read a book or something like that. And, you know, you just kind of dig into the different options until you get some, you know, cold, hard facts. And then the game automatically commits those to a notebook that you have. whereupon you can then reference that notebook and, you know, kind of get the facts lined up. And if you, you know, based on how many facts you've looked at, certain conclusions will appear. And so if your conclusion is, you know, based on things you've read, observed, spoken to the patient about, spoken to the doctor about, eventually it's all going to lead into like, oh, I believe that this rabbit has this one of the three possible diseases. And you know, once you get that right, then again, like I said, you're thrust out into the world in order to talk to everybody and find out what could be the cause of this disease, because that's what your goal is to make everybody better. So the complications come as you start to talk to people in that there is a political situation going on. Miners are on strike because of the illness. Some people, some rabbits, rather, believe that you're a plant from the higher ups trying to sow discord in the guise of like trying to help or in, you know, to like make things, what is it, to kind of defer responsibility from the higher ups for providing the rabbits with poor working conditions to begin with. You know, like there's actually like some political stuff at play here, and like it gets complex, and like there's actual storytelling here. Now, all this to say, it is not a long game. It's a couple hours long.
Yeah, it advertises 3 to 4, so I figured you could beat it in even less than that.
Yeah, there it ain't much game, you know, once you get to the heart of the matter and, you know, find out what the disease is. But that's okay, because, like I said, the devil is in the details as far as that goes. And there's a lot of writing. There's a lot of studying. There's a lot of thinking that you can do in this game. And, yeah, it's basically like a nice little afternoon of, you know, basically logic puzzles and, like, just kind of you know, learning things and then kind of applying that knowledge. Like, there's no especially complex puzzles here. There's no action. It's just walking around and talking to people. You can walk at two different speeds. I tried to play it with a gamepad, and I ran into problems there, so I ended up just using the mouse and keyboard specifically. And it's like, you know, you just click where you want to walk, and like W and S enters and exits doors and things like that. And, you know, it's like I said, it's very, very, very simple.
Yes, it seems like a good palate cleanser. Hypothetically, after covering 6 like high profile games,
exactly.
That it fits well as a palate cleanser afterwards.
Yeah, exactly. And, like, you know, the only real thing about it is that, you know, because the game cuts into, like, if you enter a building, it cuts into the interior of the building. It's a little hard to find the door again to leave the building. Like, that's literally the only, like, problem I had in the whole game. It's a small game, but it's got a lot of heart. I like that. And like this review, it's a bit on the short side.
Well, it's $5. What do you say?
Hey, $5. It's, I mean, I literally couldn't tell you, oh, there, that's cheating price. No, it's a fuck it, why not, brace, basically. I mean, it's not going to, like, take you all day to beat this thing, but it's a worthwhile experience if you got the money and you got the time.
Yeah, it's $5, so fuck it, just buy it.
Yeah.
Cool. All right, next up is Ravenlock, developed and published by Coco Cucumber, released May 4th on Xbox One, Series X, Windows, or Series X and S, Windows 10, and Epic Games Store for $24.99. Embark on an enchanting journey in Ravenlock, an action-packed fairy tale adventure about a young heroine destined to fulfill perilous prophecy. Upon encountering a mystical mirror, Ravenlock is whisked away to a whimsical world plagued by the sinister darkness of a tyrannical queen. Destiny awaits all in an unforgettable and heartfelt adventure. Aki, tell us about your time with Ravenlock.
Okay, so did you guys ever read the story Alice in Wonderland?
Never heard of it.
Oh, well, that's a shame. That's what this game is. In this, you play as a young girl that, her and her family have just moved out into the countryside because they got a free house from, like, their aunt or something who disappeared, it appears, maybe died, doesn't really explain, and, while helping move in, you find this mirror and polish it up, and then you get yanked right through that bitch into the fucky wucky world of Wonderland, and it's fantastic. this is all just a little action adventure game. It's very, it's not particularly hard at all. The hardest part of it is finding collectibles and deciding just to sit there and level up and farming experience, which you don't really need to do either until the end of the game. Basically you're just trying to help Mr. Bunny Rabbit and his family. Things have gotten weird in Wonderland because the queen is, well, if you've read Alice in Wonderland, the queen's the queen. She's a bitch. That's that's just kind of what it is. There's not a good queen. And they've locked up the castle, and it's up to you to get through that, because apparently the people who live there and would have seen where they put the keys and knows exactly where the keys are won't grab the keys because that would be too much effort for them, so they're going to have you do it instead. Whatever. It's a bunny rabbit. You just do what he says. fair enough. And throughout this, you have to find three different little keys to open the castle gates, and each area is its own little different place. There's one that's, you know, has a giant maze that you're going through. Another one's like a little forest, and one's a theater, etc., etc. And there's four major areas and a tiny hub area. Three of the areas you get a key in, and the fourth area is obviously the area past the gate, castle gates, if that wasn't obvious. You just go around and you kick the shit out of things, and it's pretty fantastic. There are a few little side quests that you can do. It's usually, you know,
a few. Find this item. This game is like Side Quest the video game. It seems like every single person you talk to is like, here's a new quest. Like, I have 40 quests to do, and you're giving me more? I mean, granted, they're all mostly story-related, but, like, in that first hour, it just throws much shit at you, and it's so hard to tell what you're supposed to focus on.
All of it.
Yeah.
That's what I decided, and I got nowhere.
It's a fairly linear game in the grand scope of things. It kind of gates you off where you're not supposed to go until you go in the progression. visually, I love what Coco Cucumber does with their games. The mix of like voxel and real graphics, and it's such a cool visually distinct game, and I really enjoy what they do with their graphics.
Yeah, this is a very pretty game, and yes, it is also extremely linear. Like all three of the different areas where you get keys, you can't just choose whichever one of them you want. You go through the first one first, because that's the only one you can go through, and then the other two you can basically do in either order up until close to the end of one of them, because you have to do the other one to finish that other one off. So it's like, you do kind of have to do each path one after another very specifically, and then obviously end game is end game.
It's not a very long game or a very in-depth game, but it's like it kind of feels the same as Riverbond in a way, one of their earlier games, where it's just like a good hop in, play for a few hours and move on kind of game. It's not something where you have to invest multiple weeks of your life in. Just a good weekend game. And it's hard to say, like, oh, it's a good Game Pass game, but it's
a fantastic Game Pass game to me, because it's a nice short thing. Yeah. I know I sat down at like 7 or 9 p.m. one day, and I just played through it all the way to like 10 a.m. the next day or something. I was like, okay, I'm done. And I 100%ed the entire thing. I just sat there and just played it straight, because I was like, it's fun.
Nice.
Yeah, I really like the visuals and the story, albeit it's very simple. It's Alice in Wonderland. So if you've read the book or watched the movies or played any of the American McGee games, you kind of know the story. It's not like it's particularly ever changed.
It's a little different in the American McGee
games. A little bit, but not a lot of bit. Because clearly all these girls are crazy. So there's some horror-y bits in this. Just they're not as quite as horror-y as that. And shame the third one's never going to come out, but whatever.
Well, it's $25. What are your thoughts on Ravenlock?
I think this is a very good game for $25. I think that that's a very good price point for it because it's short, but it's really, I thought it was really fun. It's a very simple, you know, it kids could play this and really enjoy it. You can play this, really enjoy it. I think that's a good price point for it.
And if you're worried, it's on Game Pass.
So yeah.
There you go. Next up is Trinity Trigger, developed by Furyu Corporation, published by Exceed Games, released April 25th on the Switch, PS4, PS5, and PC for $49.99. Caught in the middle of a divine clash of epic proportions that has left gigantic weapons towering over the landscape, Cyan and newfound allies Elise and Xantus set out on a quest to save the world and defy the gods. Claim your fate in this fantastical adventure inspired by classic JRPGs. Rennell, tell us about your time with Trinity Trigger.
This game was directly inspired by Secret of Mana. That's definitely the primary thought process that I came out of this with after spending time with it. That brings both positives and negatives to the table, and I will go on to that now. The idea behind this game is that you are traversing the world at large in hopes of defying a prophecy that states that you, basically the Herald of Chaos, is going to battle with the Herald of Order, and by one of you killing the other determines the fate of the world. You don't want that because that's a stupid prophecy, so your goal is to defy it and come up with a better way to get through this in one piece. And the way that this ends up happening is by way of exploring the top-down map and engaging in lots of action-style combat. Things that are borrowed from Secret of Mana are the fact that you have access to a multitude of weapons, though you have to earn them throughout the course of playing the game. Also, I guess, kind of like that game. The weapons themselves can be exchanged by way of using a weapons wheel, which, contrary to what a lot of other people might think, I love the weapons wheel in that game, and I actually like it in this game, too. I'm a big fan of being able to push a button, see a circle saying, hey, push the button in the direction of the weapon you want, and start using it willy-nilly, no menu. And it flows well in this game. When you do battle enemies with these weapons, you have access to a number of different attacks. So there is a basic attack combo. By pressing the X button up to three times, you can do a series of attacks that will do damage and potentially have side bonus effects. Each weapon has, by default, two different abilities that can be attributed to each of the three slots, and you can pick and choose them at will. And again, that determines like the arc of the attack, the amount of damage it does, and a number of other just general characteristics. So you'll be making use of that. You have access to what's called a trigger aura. Each character has one of those, and by pressing the square button, you will pull off that weapon aura, and it gives you a variety of different things based on the character who's using it. For example, Cyan, the main character, gets a massive attack boost temporarily when he uses his weapon aura. And this is filled up by beating the snot out of enemies until the gauge maximizes. There's also a trigger strike, which you can activate by pressing the triangle button, another case of dependent on what character you are using. But basically the trigger strike will activate and perform a special attack that you can, you know, pretty much feel good about using. Though chances are you'll likely be using it for things like boss fights or whatnot. Again, it's dependent on the character who's using it and also the weapon that they're using when they do it. So keep that in mind. Why would you use different weapons instead of just using your favorite all the freaking time? Well, that's because the way this game is designed, they did a few special things that make the weapons all have their own special purposes. One, enemies have weaknesses. They might be weak to a certain weapon type, and while or strong against a weapon type. And if you use the one that they're strong against, you'll do piddling damage to the point where it's not even worth it. In addition to that, sometimes enemies, when you kill them, they will drop materials, which can be used in, you know, crafting equipment, buffs, and such. But monsters also have a special weapon that if you kill them with that, you'll get a unique drop. Which means sometimes, kind of like what I'm doing right now, in fact, you'll find yourself farming for enemies by killing them with a specific weapon of choice to get that item for use in crafting. Bosses make weapons even more important because when you fight a big boss battle, the enemy themselves has a, before you can even hit their life bar, they have a wall that you have to chip away at bit by bit until you clear it and start doing damage to them. The wall itself doesn't come down unless you hit them with their weakness. You can get it down pretty slowly, but the game's already, the battles already take long enough as it is. When you use the weapon you're supposed to use, heaven help you if you decide you want to ignore their weapon weakness and just chip away at them. You'll be there for a very long time. Don't do that. So you'll be making use of weapons constantly throughout that way. And each of the characters get access to these weapons. However, you don't unlock them at the same time. As you're exploring the world, you find yourself adventuring and exploring the occasional arma, basically giant weapons that have fallen from the sky, lodged themselves into the ground, and have become dungeons. Because, yeah, that makes sense. You run inside of the dungeon, explore it, and at the end of the dungeon, you may find a shrine that, assuming it matches the elemental type of the trigger creature your character is based around, that determines if that character will get the weapon. For example, you might enter the bow armor and get to the end of it, and the aura shrine is actually of a water type, which is Cyan's elemental trigger type, which means now he can get access to bow attacks, and he can switch between the weapons he's already got and now the newfound bow. You are kind of running around going through the motions and just beating dudes up with your weapons, but there are, and at the surface, that seems like it'd be fun. Customizing the equipment by using, like manacom crystals to basically give yourself a variety of buffs, like experience gains, or attack boosting, or defense against different status types and all. That stuff has a little bit of fun aspects to it too. Lots of good times there, except there are a few things here that drive me freaking crazy. Some people might not have these issues, but I do, and this might be a plus for you, so hear me out. Each weapon, as in Cyan's sword, or Arisa's sword, basically, they all have their own equipment, augmentation. So, an attack augmentation set and a defense augmentation set. So you're equipping up to a minimum or so, like 4 gems that all do different buffs. If you switch from that weapon to the next weapon, that weapon has its own need to have gems equipped to give it buffs. So ultimately, by the end of the game, you will be switching between gems for 8, 16, 24 weapons, 8 per character, each with their own gem slots. Obviously, you might be hearing this and going, well, duh, I'm not going to use all the weapons for all the characters. And yeah, that's true. You likely won't. But you still will be juggling gems across a multitude of weapons where it'd be nice if you could just say, look, I'm using these gems, and by pressing this button, all weapons use these same 3 gems on this one character unless I want to diversify. Give me the ability to not have to micromanage so much. The second thing, and quite possibly the thing that drives me the craziest, is the fact that the AI in this game is a little wonky. On the positive, funny enough, I mean, it's doing what its inspiration Secret of Mana did, too, because that game, when you take the rose-colored glasses off, that game has some terrible character AI also. And you spent a lot of time just spamming healing spells and items just to keep people alive when you'd rather just get sidelined until you beat the big bad boss enemy or whatever. But in this game, yes, you will find yourself fighting bosses where they will be just in lines way of an attack, and you're just watching them get the stuffing kicked out of them. Now, fortunately, you can mitigate that slightly by switching to the character, by pressing one of the trigger buttons. Like, if you see the red aura show up, indicating the attack range is about to be inflicted, and your guy is in the middle of it, and they can't get it out, press that button, switch to them, get them out of the way. But a lot of times, you don't want to do this. So your characters might find yourself just eating damage from whatever, whether it's like a standing trap item or a boss attack or whatever. So if that happens, just be ready to spam a bunch of potions. Why did I say potions? Because there's no magic in this game. That's probably my last gripe, though you can take or leave that depending as well. Secret of Mana, one of the most fun aspects of that game, for better or worse, was the fact that you would liberate elemental shrines and get spears that would give you 6 different spells per, shrine. 3 attack spells and 3 support spells. In this game, there is no magic. So all of your attacks and all of your damage output and all of your, you know, finagling is going to be limited specifically to those weapons that you're using. So I feel like the problem there is that it limits some of the combat potential because you are ultimately wham, 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 but there's no dodge button. That's just a dodge button, so there's no block button. So you have to dodge everything. No blocking, and means you will eat a lot of damage in this game. But does that mean I think the game is bad? No. I actually am enjoying the game. I do think the game is legitimately fun. I just wish there was a little bit more to it as far as like my combat options outside of just like whamming on guys with the melee attacks on my weaponry. It does get helped, though, also by the character voice acting. The voice actors in this game, they did a fantastic job with them. I like hearing the characters during their conversations. I like the exchange they have. However, contrary to that, where they didn't go well is the combat dialogue, in which these characters talk a lot and they will not shut up. I mean, they talk about everything and they say the same lines over and over and over again. Oh, no. It drives me crazy and I wish they didn't do that. And it's an easy fix in some ways. If they had an option in the menu to just turn battle voices off, problem solved. Or maybe a toggle that says, like, not common dialogue, so that when they do speak, it's like, oh, wow, he just made a taunt about his bow attack. That feels nice to hear. But instead, there's no option. It's all or all. You're stuck with it. And it drives me crazy. Ooh, ooh. No one else.
Crazy bit driving you with the voices. It's a $50 game. What are your thoughts on it? Is it too much? It seems like for a retro game. Then again, we just covered Live Alive, which is $50 as well. So
yeah, but I will say this doesn't hit where Live Alive does. It does have positive perks, and I do feel like there's fun to be had in this game. And I am looking at my Switch copy sitting on my coffee table as I make this exact statement. I will say, if I'm saying price be damned, I would give it a buy. But a lot of people, no, I'm rephrasing it, I'd give it a try. But a lot of people might find themselves thinking, man, $50 is a bit much for these comments that he's making, though. In which case, I say, well, fine, just get it on a sale. For me, when it comes to a lot of this kind of stuff, when I give these reviews, the price kind of comes secondary because due to the fact that we live in a world where sales exist.
In a world.
The buy it generally revolves around, if I say buy it, that's like me saying, I'm going to buy it regardless of the price. I'm happy with this. I want it now. Try it implies, you know, you can get it now. You can get it on a sale. Whatever the price point is, that makes you feel like this is worth a game that he was kind of lukewarm on, you know. But I don't dislike it. It's just, this isn't go out and buy this game today. It's like, eh. Sometimes, I guess the best way to describe this is the fact that there's games like Secret of Mana that we all have played and we thought were fantastic games. And even if you play them today, they're still fun. But how much of that is because you're looking at it through that nostalgia lens and not because you're able to say now, man, some of these mechanics, they could have done better with these. Or, man, this could have been a little bit better if they'd done this. Because when that's the mindset you've got, and then someone makes a game that kind of plays like that, but they don't make any improvements to that, as I tell you, but there is one improvement, and I'll make that, and I'll stop talking about the game, I swear. No. Yes, I will. Maybe. We'll see. Secret of Mana, one of the things that made that game annoying as far as combat went was the fact that you had that 100% gauge, and when you were in a combat structure, you were kind of like hobbling along. You couldn't run around. You were locked into place with no real room to maneuver and dodge things. In this game, you do have something similar to the 100% gauge where as you do attacks, a stamina gauge of sorts goes down. And when it tops out, when it bottoms out, your attacks pretty much do no damage. You have to wait for it to recover. So you can't just like mash X to win forever. But the trade-off there that I think is better than Secret of Mana is that you can run around in battle. You're not stuck doing that weird hobble limping thing. And you're also not charging your special attack up for 8 goddamn meters waiting for it to get to where it needs to be. You can just start beating dudes up. That, to me, is a solid improvement on the combat mechanic, and I do think that helps make the game pretty fun. So I do give this a solid try it. Because I do believe that people who are aping for more of that will enjoy it. Just know that you're going to be coming into it with a few blemishes to top off the otherwise beautiful thing, precious thing you're going to get.
Cool. All right. Well, we are halfway through the episode. Are you guys ready to dive into this?
the kiss my ass. No, we're done. We're done.
I am now freaked out. I was like, wait, there's fucking more?
We are done.
5-hour episode tonight. No, we got one final game to talk about tonight. That is called Murtop, developed and published by Flynn's Arcade. It released May 18th on the Switch for $4.99. Murtop is a fast-paced arcade game packed with action as if it was taken directly out of the 80s. Do you have enough coins to beat it? Chris, how many coins did you throw into your Switch?
Zero. Oh. That is not a good thing to do to your Switch.
That's not what the vents on top are for.
Yeah. By the way, shout outs to Purnell. I love it when a review summary, ends up being a "we live in a society" statement. that's very, very artful, sir.
Oh, right. Thank you very much.
Okay, so this, this is a fast paced game. This is gonna be a fast paced review.
Thank God, it's been so long tonight.
I know, right? Okay, so in this game, this is a arcade game. It looks like a MAME game because it even starts with like the MAME like startup type thing. So like they're really true to form. Which reminds me of Donut Dodo, which this Flynn's Arcade also published, although this is a different developer apparently. So in this game, you are a rabbit, and you are not a rabbit with special powers or special skills or a special appearance or anything like that. You're just a rabbit. Which, by the way, that's I guess we have three games that referenced rabbits this time, not done by Brooke, which is odd. But anyways,
it's okay. We'll get her a bunny one next week.
We will indeed. So, you start at the top of the screen, and below the screen, there are moles digging around in tunnels. The moles are your immortal enemies. They are digging for carrots, which you can see. You are going to use your digging skills to get to those carrots. Old arcade heads are going to immediately recognize the dig-dugginess of the whole affair, because you are basically going up, down, left, and right, down these tunnels and such. You can freely move across what is essentially a grid of squares. But here's where the twist comes in. Your rabbit, fueled by the power of what I can only imagine are some pretty bomb-ass carrots, gets to drop a bomb out of his ass. So, these are literally bomb-ass carrots.
Sweet.
The carrots give you fuel to poop out a bomb, a cartoon bomb, and that bomb is going to explode, and it explodes in a cross formation, the length of which is determined, I think, by how many carrots you eat, but I'm not exactly sure. The game doesn't really explain too much, because it's an old arcade game style type game. So the point is to get those bombs and their explosion trajectories in the path of those naughty moles, and then blow them up until they are dead, and then you move on to the next stage. Repeat 256 times, apparently, according to the game's sales page. It says 256 screen time limited stages and a kill screen. So that's a old Pac-Man reference. Actually, did Donkey Kong have a kill screen too? I know Pac-Man did, so... But yeah, Pac-Man, after a certain value, it would just repeat stages until it just crashed, and that's the infamous kill screen. So that's what we're dealing with here, is people who clearly know a lot about old arcade games making one. The soundtrack is great. It's a nice chiptune-y soundtrack that sounds a little advanced for the era, but, I mean, it's catchy and toe-tapping, and that's what we really want, right? Who cares if it sounds like Dig Dug? It sounds better. that's what we want. Animation, really nice. That rabbit's actually got quite a few frames to it. It even does a little sweat, like a little sweat drop when it poops out that big lit bomb out of its hindquarters, which I'm like, fair play to him. The game's pretty funny. Like I said, the moles all kind of look like there's variations of them. They kind of do different things. They act in different patterns. The fun is kind of learning that and what to do, and also to kind of line up that bomb, because it's always going to appear on the square behind you, so you can't just like drop it on the same square you're on. So there's a little bit of getting yourself in the right position to really lay it on them. And I had a lot of fun with this one. It's a nice little game, and it's actually cheaper than authentic arcade games are to download, so that's a big plus. The bonuses as well, you get a couple of bezel choices. You get Tate mode. You can do different scalings, you know, if you want pixel perfect scaling, which is funny to me because, you know, it's like this is a made from scratch kind of arcade game. You'd think, I don't know, whatever. Like, they really, really did the work in making this indistinguishable from one of the other arcade games that you can download. And
does it have a CRT filter I'm going to turn off immediately?
Yes, it doesn't even, you have to turn it on. It's not even on by default. Yeah. You can also switch to different color palettes, which I guess affects the kind of overall look of it. I didn't really mess with that too much. Glad it's there. There's a lot of different things here, but yeah, ultimately this is very much a kind of an arcade game that never was, but now is. So,
well, it's $5. What's your verdict?
Yeah, this is a buy-in. I mean, come on. Like I said, it's cheaper than other arcade games, and it's just as good. So,
sounds good.
Easy review on that. By the way, we live in a society, and
the society. All right, now we're halfway through the episode.
Right.
We live in a society where this episode is over.
This episode is over. Thanks to you three for being here, hanging out to the end of the show. Thanks to Adam for coming on, doing his thing, to Brooke and Tim for doing their thing. Music.
Did her thing.
Well, I said you three. Oh, he was included in that. I included her this time. I remembered this time.
Count. Yeah, because I see four on the phone call. So thank you, Joe. Ha-ha.
Music this episode. Since we did Star Wars Jedi Survivor, I've never really had an excuse to play this, but we're going to play Vert's version of the Star Wars theme. Are you familiar with it?
No.
It is entirely a cappella.
Perfect.
It's a minute long, and it is amazing. And that's our music for the episode. Does anyone have any final words to end the show?
We live in a society.